That effervescence. Yeah, this is it. Swan Song 300, Part A. That's right, I said Part A. Welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight, talking about Heat from 1995, written and directed by Michael Mann, starring Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Val Kilmer, Tom Sizemore, Ashley Judd, Natalie Portman, John Voight, Danny Trio. I was going to try and do them all. Danny Trio, Dennis Haspard, Michael T. Williams, Tone Loke, Jeremy Piven, and Bud Cort, and Wayne Grow, whose name, you know, but I don't remember his damn. It's a great name. What is his name?
I don't remember his name either.
Wayne Grow from Chrome Skull.
Wayne Grow from Chrome Skull.
Right.
Yep.
Michael Mann started researching, like, prisoners and crime stuff in Chicago, like, 15 years before this movie got made. And he actually produced, like, a TV movie that was, like, the first 40 pages of the script to this. And eventually it got fleshed out and became this, which is probably the ultimate cops and robber crime noir story. Yeah, it was made in 95, and that was pretty much it. I don't think there's been a better movie than Heat in that genre since. I think that a lot of them probably aspire to it, but don't quite achieve that. I mean, you have movies like The Town about, like, a group of robbers in Boston, and it's more about, like, Boston culture and very little to do with the police relationship there. You have movies like, you have period films about crime, like another Michael Mann film, Public Enemies, which I think I was sort of in the minority about liking. A lot of people didn't like that movie.
What was the movie?
Public Enemies, the Johnny Depp, Dillinger movie. But this is your kind of end-all, be-all. It's 3 hours long, but it doesn't have pacing problems, so it doesn't really feel long. I mean, like,
you forgot Amy Brennan.
Right, I forgot about Amy. I forgot what's her name too. Al Pacino's old lady, Diane Venora, I think.
Yes, right. Very good. And you forgot Hank Azaria.
Forgot about Hank Azaria. This movie just had. I forgot about Tom Noonan of all people.
Oh right, Tom Noonan.
Oh God, it's Kelso.
Kelso.
Shit, you can't forget about Tom Noonan.
Oh, and actually, I think you did remember him.
Who?
Oh, and you forgot Henry Rollins.
Oh, I forgot about Bill Fichtner.
Right.
As Van Zandt. God, everybody that's awesome is in the... I mean, it's not even that they're awesome, it's just that they are awesome because they're in this movie. Like, you know that's gotta be, like, huge claim to fame to so many people. It's like, whether you give a shit about Henry Rollins, he's in Heat, and that makes him awesome. You know?
That does make him awesome.
Like, I mean, like, Natalie Portman lucked out. Like, she's the youngest cast member, but, like, no matter what else she does, she could go on to just do shitty rom-coms like she's doing now or whatever. Like, so I don't give a shit about winning an Oscar for playing a psycho dancer, whatever. That doesn't mean anything to me. She was in Heat. Like I said,
she had a pretty decent run early on.
It's the end-all, be-all. Yeah, but he was before Beautiful Girls, I want to say. Maybe it was close.
Beautiful Girls, I think, was 96.
Okay, so yeah, he was like, I mean, it wasn't much after, like, Professional. She was still
that
really
was
young.
92?
No, it must have been like 93 or 94.
Was it?
I don't know exactly, but I'm fairly certain that she hadn't done much at that point. I mean, she had done enough that, like, she was on radars of people like Michael Mann and stuff. I'm sure they had a casting audition or whatever, but her role is not the most important role in the film. But that's not really true either, because there's so many characters and so many stories, and every piece is sort of important. And even the guy that Diane Venora cheats on, what was his name? Ralph or whatever?
Ralph.
Yeah. That guy's a known actor. He's good and stuff.
Oh, well, there are a number of people I recognize. I just don't know their names.
Right, yeah. Okay, so it's 3 hours. I don't think even the first time I saw it, you know, it's like a rich, it's like full like 5-course meal and a dessert type of movie, to use a food analogy. So you're full by the time it's done, and maybe a little to the brim the first time you've seen it, but I don't think you feel like grossed out. It doesn't feel like an arduous long film. I don't think there's dead points in the second act like a lot of long films have problems with, or things that are like self-indulgent B-plots or subplots that are like, you know what, if this director had less clout, then the studio would have made them cut that and it would have been a better movie, like you see occasionally in movies, especially nowadays when it's become okay to make movies that are well over 2 hours just because Titanic did so well or something. I don't know what that's all about. But yeah, this film is very well paced. I checked it when I was watching the commentary, and I paused it, and it was 11 minutes in, and it was probably about a minute after the actual first heist happens with the armored truck. And yeah, that's like by the numbers inciting event stuff. The inciting event has to happen on page 10, you know, hard and fast in order for like a good film, you know, a traditional Hollywood narrative type film. And it does. I mean, it, boom, that, the heist. I mean, you could say the inciting event is Wayne Grow doing what he does, but that's not really it. It really is just the heist. It's just, literally, it's that once that truck hits it, and it probably happens like right at the 10-minute mark. Up until then, you've got a lot of questions. It's just genius in the way the movie's put together, because you start with this sort of slow, from black to fade up, and this kind of like music that's both ominous and different. It was a very unique score for the time, and we can talk more about the score later, but I kind of want to do this like, I want to do justice to this movie, so I want to talk about it like as it unfolds and not go back and forth. Just so you say, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Heat in the last 2 to 3 years, you're doing yourself a disservice to listen to this. If you haven't seen it at all, you're obviously doing yourself a disservice to listen to this. Go see the movie. It's very good. Starting from the beginning, in the commentary, Michael Mann was saying, that's the end of the line on that track in L.A., and it's the same spot that Collateral ended. He's like, well, coincidentally, it's sort of the same spot Collateral ended. And it hadn't even officially opened yet when they shot Heat there. That track wasn't officially going.
Oh.
So it's the funny thing about that image, and I remember telling you this, and even the first time I saw it, is back in 90... I mean, L.A. was known for not mass transit, not having things like that. And L.A. was known as the car culture. And you had films like Falling Down and stuff that were a big part of it. And music videos like Everybody Hurts. That were this whole idea of L.A. and car traffic. And that's what you think about when you think of L.A. You don't think of public transportation. You don't think of elevated trains. And this shot of this train pulling up is very much so like... It's foreign. It's like, this is not... Where is this? This doesn't look like Chicago. Just the color scheme and the general sort of background and the open spaceness, it doesn't feel that way. But you're seeing something that's more indicative of a place that's not Los Angeles. But it is. And that's because it was just so new at the time. But that's a quintessential noir image, too, which is a train like that pulling up. And then a guy gets out of it, and it's De Niro, and he's doing something. He's on a mission, and, like, why is he taking public transport? And, you know, what's going on? He's walking through this hospital, and you're immediately given all of this information about the kind of world that this story is going to take place in. You know, you're seeing... It's a hospital that has, like, pretty heavy trauma, because it's in L.A. in the 90s. And, you know, gang violence and gunshot wounds and all kinds of nifty shit's going on all around him. He's just passing through it. He's moving through it completely unaffected on a mission. He bumps the door with his elbow, not leaving any fingerprints, and pops in an ambulance and takes off. And as far as you know, maybe he works for the ambulance company. Who knows? There's a question there. And then cut to another foreign thing that's, you know... Val Kilmer's character purchasing something like in a desert somewhere, and you still haven't. So up to this point, you still haven't really gotten a grounded sense of where this story is taking place or what the environment is. Then cut to a coffee shop and two guys that have never met each other meeting each other. You know, one jumps on a truck and says his name. Hey, who are you? Whatever. You know, and it's like, okay, are they going to work? And they're going to work. and it feels like they're going to work, but that what they're going to do is a little bit different. And then you start to see that all these pieces are connecting, and then this heist comes down, and it's done with like precision and execution, and you know these guys don't fuck around. You know these guys are pros. And yeah, that's the inciting event. That's the first like 10 minutes of that movie. God, I'm confused about the timeline now. Do we get Pacino before the heist happens? Do we get the whole lovemaking thing that's after the heist? I think we might get that little bit and he goes off to work, but maybe not. But we get like, I mean, his whole thing starts. And that's the other thing I like about the film is it doesn't fall into this like crime suspense thriller thing that a lot of movies in the late in the 80s and 90s were falling into, which is like having to be sort of very explicit sexually, kind of like going to that as a source of like angst and drama and tension and all kinds of, you know, Basic Instinct kind of things. Like, it doesn't feel like it needs to just throw in a bunch of like sexual stuff. It does a little bit of it at the beginning, and it's judicious about the way that it does it. And it's, like you said, it's got a certain kind of desperate realism in it with Pacino and his wife, and like sort of the beginning of the end of their marriage is hinted at just without words there, you know?
Oh, right. When she hits the prescription bottle.
Right. As soon as he's on his way out, you know, no time.
And, you know, it's kind of funny. I remember to sound quality, and I mentioned it to you when we were watching the movie. This is the first time I remember the sound being so clear that you could hear the cigarette.
Right. The burning of a cigarette.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now I can get into the problems I have with the movie here towards the end, but yeah, things like sound quality, like they really. There's a lot of good craftspeople involved in this film
It starts off with Natalie Portman's character's problems too, because she has a breakdown.
Yeah. That one is pretty simple, but it's authentic, and it's like you get that point of within his life there is this woman that he's married to, and she's got a kid, and this kid is messed up. This kid is in a bad place. He never talks about his kids,
but it's his third marriage.
Right, yeah. Well, you get the impression he probably doesn't have any, unless they alluded to it when you get in the exposition that happens later. No, so then, okay, boom, there's a heist. The heist happens. Something goes wrong because they got a new guy on the crew, and the new guy is a bit of a psycho, bit of a loose cannon, and that's not the way this crew runs, and clearly this guy is not great, so things go shit. They have to kill the armored car guards. They did not intend to do that. They was not part of the plan. They're thieves primarily. They're not murderers. But once it bumps up to a murder 1B for all of them, then why leave a witness? And they just take everybody else out with impunity, and then they get the hell out of there. And they've got an exit strategy set up. They throw down the spike strip, which debilitates some of the police, and then they get away and burn the evidence of the van, the ambulance that they stole, and they're off. Things are untraceable, and it's hard to get a hold of them. And you get all of that when Pacino arrives as the main investigator, the main cop on the scene. Vincent Hanna, I want to say he's a lieutenant.
Yep, lieutenant detective.
Lieutenant detective of a robbery homicide, a major crime unit, MCU. In Los Angeles County.
Los Angeles City.
Well, city, yeah. He's not a sheriff or anything, right? And, you get right into the investigation and his process as an investigator and his leadership. And they go back to that a few times. But just, you know, he's just, boom, he's to all of his other detectives, he's just like, do this, do that, check this, check that. The only bit of a clue of evidence that they have is that, you know, a hobo that was sort of hidden in the dirt in the corner that kind of witnessed some of this and heard some of what they said, and so he gives them one piece of evidence that somebody called somebody Slick, and that's all they have. And of course Pacino says, check Slick with the FBI alias database, you know, you're gonna get the phone book, but do it anyway. And it's just like the writing in that it's stylized, but it's awesome, and it's just like he's moving so fast. Pacino to me in this film is comparable to like a like a Harvey Keitel, like a Winston Wolfe character from Pulp Fiction.
I can see that.
Totally just like he's on the ball, he thinks fast, he moves fast, you know, keep up, you know? Snap, 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 here's where we're going. And his detectives, at this point, are the guys that have worked with him, they clearly, like, work with him. and they flow, and he knows how to use each one of them to do certain things, and so on and so forth. And they're all on it. They're all just, like, Wes Studi, who's pretty good, is one of the detectives. And like I said, Michael T. Williams, and Ted Levine, another guy.
I didn't bring up Ted Levine.
And then there's the... there's, like, the surfer cool detective that's in it a little, too, which I thought was kind of funny. You know, he'd be, like, the
blonde dude with the mullet.
The blonde dude with the mullet is kind of like the Keanu Reeves stand-in or something. So then you get the crew having their sort of debriefing at the coffee shop, and Wayne Grove being like, look, I had to get it on. He was going for it. And they weren't hearing any of this, but they were like, we're going to pay you off, so let's go outside and do that. And they're all ready to take this guy out, and then something happens.
Why leave a witness?
A black and white shows up just in the wrong time. And it's kind of a convenience, but I mean, in L.A., it's not unbelievable. And just in typical L.A. fashion, it flips a Huey and disappears, too.
You know what's funny? I almost never see them. When I'm in L.A., I see CHP all over the place.
Right.
Maybe they just don't hit the... I've driven a lot through, you know, various...
Cityed areas.
Yeah, various cityed areas, and you just... You almost never fucking see them. It's... Every now and then I'll see a Los Angeles County Sheriff.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, that happens, and Wayne Grove gets away. And he knows that they're after him, and then he disappears, and it's like a loose end, but... There's so much else going on that they kind of have to move on, and they do.
I always wondered about that, because there really aren't very many truck stops down there. It's kind of scary.
Right.
It's like, usually if I'm in L.A., I'll generally drive to Ontario, you know, like 50,
right, yeah,
60 miles away, because it's really the closest truck stops that I could stop at.
Right.
And that diner was a truck stop.
That's right, it was.
Yeah, and I was like, where the fuck is that?
Well, you know, 95, man. A lot of things, like this will lead into the next section. The next section, Vincent's going to talk to one of his CIs, where they actually have, like, real-life cockfights and dog fights. And it's this great little piece of, you know, a little community.
Oh, the chop shop?
The chop shop, and you've got the big pile of sulfur behind him, the big yellow pile in one of the shots. It's great, environment for things to happen. And that's not there anymore. Parts of it aren't there anymore. You know, 10, 15 years later, whenever they were doing the special features on the film, they were talking about how, yeah, this isn't this way anymore. And you get Pacino doing more of his... I mean, this is early... I think 95... This has got to be before... he went full on out and did Scent of a Woman, right?
No, Scent of a Woman was like 92.
Really? It was before that?
Yeah.
Okay, so he backed it down then to do this. He was still... Pacino could still... I'm going to say this. As far as I'm concerned, Heat is the last movie where both Pacino and De Niro were... at the peak of the, at their, like, these are spectacular actors doing their thing. I don't think De Niro did too many particularly good movies after Heat. I mean, he did Ronin and stuff, which is good.
Ronin was all right, but I liked that movie, Marlon Brando's last movie.
The score.
I liked the score.
The score was okay. But yeah, so Pacino's talking to a CI, and he's throwing him off, doing all kinds of crazy, like, what do you got? You know, he's doing loud.
Give me all you got.
Yeah. And looking around, and Michael Mann on the commentary was talking about, like, how he had to, like, leave the set because it was...
Would you fucking out?
It was cracking him up so much. He's like, what, was he here? Look out of the table and stuff. And some of that stuff, I think, is more improv stuff that he did to throw off the other actor. But in this case, I think it was kind of stuff that him and Pacino talked about, being like that's the kind of way that character is. That's the way you behave with CIs, you know, because it intimidates them and they never don't really know where they stand and stuff. And so he tells him that his brother will tell him something, might have some information for him. And so you're like, okay, fine. And it's this, I mean, the first watching of the film, this whole scene feels so far removed. You're seeing these environments with each new scene. Pretty much every scene is a different environment on some level. I mean, there's a few they go back to, like both of the homes, the home for Pacino, the home for De Niro, they go back to three or four times. For the most part, every scene is a new location and a new environment in that sense, and sort of it's part. I mean, the city, it sounds cliche and it sounds kind of hokey to say this, but the city is definitely a character in this film. And Michael Mann has always been good, in my opinion, at putting you in the environment, like making you feel very much so like you are enveloped by that place, and he does it very well. So the next section is, I want to say the next section is when he's talking to Kelso, is with De Niro talking to Kelso about the next job while Nate's setting up the score with Van Zandt. There might be another whole scene where just Nate and John Voight's character, who's kind of plays this sort of aged hippie type of guy, but maybe not. I don't know. There's something cool about that character. I like that guy. I like his character, and it's interesting, you know.
Yeah,
John Voight is. I mean, that's the other thing, is that some of these roles are small in terms of the screen time, but they're all like there. Like Tom Noonan is in the film for one scene. But it's like that's a full character in that scene, you know, talking, and you get like a lot about that guy. You see like that he's in a wheelchair, but he's got these antennas, that he's kind of like a proto hacker type or something, you know. He's just grabbing that information. It's out there in the ether, you know.
He's fighting the man.
He knows how to grab it. He sets up scores and sells them, you know.
Yeah, it seemed like a pretty good living.
Yeah, for sure, you know. Just do all the prep work and then don't have to deal with any of the any of the repercussions, really. And that location is great. Apparently that location is a pretty scary place to be at night in terms of gang violence, at least back in the 90s.
Kelso's?
Yeah, Kelso's place up on a hill somewhere in some part of LA. But it looks down onto those freeways, and we talked about that when we were watching it. Just those like massive veins into a city kind of thing. And that's another case of him really putting you in the environment of being in that place that is, you know, Southern California, you know. So they set up the scores. Oh, I don't know, I'm not going to do this plot by plot point. It's just, but so many of the scenes are so good. And, you know, you start to see the various lives of some of these characters. You don't get everything from everybody, but you get just enough to kind of see where they stand. And you know that De Niro is definitely a loner. You know that Kilmer's character has, like, a wife and a kid. And that his wife is very much so pushing the whole, like, domesticity, like, risk and reward. Like, you have to, you know, she just wants to have enough money to actually have a family and make that work. But Kilmer's a degenerate gambler, so he keeps blowing that. And so he has to keep going out and risking more, you know, things.
Not only that, he keeps a little something on the side.
He's got something on the side, nothing regular. Yeah, Ashley Judd's character is kind of another good character in the story too, you know, and there's something for her to do and things happen with her, including her cheating on Kilmer with Hank Azaria's character, who's the liquor hole salesman from Vegas. And everything connects. Like, you could see how she could have met him in Vegas when she was there with her husband, and her husband was obsessively gambling. And she could be, like, you could just literally, you could feel the story of how she met the guy she's cheating on Kilmer's character with. Like, some night, he's crazy gambling, she yells at him about doing it too much, he yells at her, they go their separate ways on the floor or whatever, and she meets this guy in a bar and is just pissed off at her husband at the time, and this guy seems like maybe he's a more legit, like, practical sort of guy, but of course she still loves Kilmer and blah blah blah. But it's like, that's just good writing when you have all these characters, but they all kind of have a place to fit, and they all feel, it makes them all feel like they're operating in a real world where there's consequences for everything that they do and all of that, you know. Like, in some way you can almost get that she's cheating on Kilmer not because she's so much a bad person, but because of, you know, it's a consequence of his gambling.
Like poor Ralph.
Yeah, well, Ralph, yeah. That was a different situation with,
where she's got to demean herself.
Demean herself with Ralph, yeah.
Poor Ralph.
Poor Ralph.
He couldn't even watch the TV.
It wasn't his TV, man.
No, it wasn't his TV.
A lot of stuff was pulled from real life. From a guy named Chuck, I want to say Chuck Adams or Chuck Adamson, is the Hannah character, a Chicago cop who knew the real Neil McCulley, or Neil McNeil, or whatever his name was, the Robert De Niro character. And they actually had a cup of coffee one time. They actually did that. All that actually happened. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that the scene happened as written, you know. But they met each other one time getting laundry or something like. And so the special features on Heat are definitely worth watching. When you watch it, get the version with all the nifty special features. Yeah, I mean, basically, just the crime story evolves. The De Niro character is working to take down a metal place to get some platinum or something in some storage unit, and the Pacino character finally gets a bead on one of his CIs, pays off, and he gets a name.
Tone Loc.
From Tone Loc. That Passenger song, the U2 Brian Eno score, when he pulls up to the place. I really wish they just had kept that as he walked through the whole thing. I don't like the House of Pain music there. Now, and maybe it's less authentic to have kept that music, but I just felt like they should have just kept that music. That driving, you know, U2 Brian Eno music as he's going into the club and stuff. I would have preferred that music to cutting to House of Pain. But, I mean, that is one of the few pieces of diegetic music that's in the film. You know, music that's happening in the actual movie, you know, is that House of Pain, which isn't on the score, I don't think. Isn't in the soundtrack.
No, it isn't.
Which is fine, because it doesn't fit. But it's probably not supposed to fit. It's like, this is the kind of music that we would be playing at a club like this, so there you go, you know? It doesn't fit
the mood of this movie. Music moment that I always thought was effective was Wayne growing the prostitute, and then he's...
Oh,
the
yeah.
The guy opens the beer bottle.
Oh, that's a good cut. Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit hokey, but it's fine. I mean, this movie is stylized in places, and that's okay. And, I mean, it was made in 95, like I said, 16 years ago. And so they had cell phones, but they were kind of clunky, and technology was what it was, and so what? You have to you almost have to watch this movie with the same way that you watch, like, Maltese Falcon or other noir stories that are set, you know, that were made in the 30s and 40s and 50s, you know? Something like The Killing, like Kubrick's film, which is about robbers. Have you seen that film?
No, I never did.
The Killing, the Kubrick movie, where the guys rob the racetrack. It's really good. You'd like it. Sterling Hayden and stuff.
Well, I still haven't seen Pelham 1-2-3 either.
The original? That's a 70s, sort of more of a... it's not quite a noir, but it's got kind of a exploitation kind of quality to it, to a degree. Maybe not really. Not technically. I mean, style-wise, maybe, but not, like, in terms of the content. Walter Matthau's good. And Robert Shaw. But yeah, The Killing is a solid movie. And The Killing is another one of those ones where you get your crew, you get your varied types of people, and there's, like, it's hard to tell a good cops and robbers story, because either it's, like, you make the cops the good guys, and you make the robbers the bad guys, or you kind of schmaltzily make there be some vague empathy for the robbers, or you try to flip it on its end and make the cops the bad guys, and the robbers kind of these Robin Hood-y sort of raging against the machine, good guy, bad guy, anti-heroes or something. And in Heat, they don't really do any of that. He just tells a story with well-written, complex characters, and you feel about them how you feel about actual people. There is that ambivalence, and there is, you know, that, that natural really empathy.
There is a villain. Wayngrow's the villain.
Well, right, there is... Wayngrow is, like, probably the most... And even he's got some degree of complexity to him. I mean, it's all evil, but he's totally... And like you said, in that scene with the prostitute, with the music, you get, like, almost, like, horror movie level, like, evil from this guy. The way he talks, the way he looks.
He starts talking about the Grim Reaper, who's got a swastika.
He's got the swastika tattoo, the white power stuff. I mean, he's just, like, he's emblematic of pure evil, you know? You know, as we identify it now... You know, with Nazism and all that stuff, you know, like that's just like that's go to, that's bad. There's no way to spin that.
The Aryan Brotherhood.
Yeah. But it was a prison thing. Time, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, man did the research and based that on a real person that he, you know, interviewed and stuff. And so, yeah, so Wayne Grove is definitely representative of this, like, pervasive, pure evil. And that's why it's so effective at the end with De Niro's character. But the big theme with De Niro's character, of course, is some advice he got back when he was young, when he had made the mistake and got sent to prison, got sent to jail, done some time in Folsom or whatever, and, someone told him, if you want to be making moves on the street, you can't get yourself bogged down, you can't get yourself involved with anything, you can't drop in 30 seconds flat if you can feel the heat coming around the corner. By the heat, the guy meant cops. That's, a term for cops, that's a term for... But I think it's also just a term for when things are just going to spiral into chaos and not going to work out for you. Things are going to get bad. Things that you're not going to be able to control the situation. And, that's a big part of Neil McCulley's situation. That's Dev De Niro's thing. It's why he's so cold, so focused, and so unattached. He lives in this house with 4 dishes and 4 glasses. The minimum set of things that you'd be able to buy.
A coffee maker without a lid,
because it probably got moved from the last place or who knows what, and no furniture. And
when he gets around to it.
Yeah, when he gets around to it, which might not happen because he might not be there very long. He needs to be ready to leave at any moment, and that place is totally like that. There's no art on the walls. It's a blank canvas, kind of like him. It just creates this great sort of lonely image. Michael Mann said in the commentary that the image of the gun sitting on the table with the guy looking out towards, out the window, towards the ocean or whatever, like that was a painting he saw. That was that image. And he was like, and it's like the way I think about stuff too, where I'm more interested in imagery and things that has more questions than answers in terms of like, oh, it's this, that's what it is. It's a nice day with a bird flying in the sky. It's like, no, there's a story there. There's a question there. Like, that guy is a loner and he's alone and there's a gun and what's this all about, like, is he a cop? Is he a hitman? Is he a mafia guy? Is he suicidal? Is he, you get that with that whole little shot of De Niro too. You get that sort of pervasive kind of quiet solitude, loneliness element juxtaposed with Val Kilmer arguing with his wife. And then you get De Niro ending up in a one night stand with a woman who just recognized him from the bookstore that he goes to where he does his research about metals and things, because he's a pro, so he has to understand these things. He has to be kind of a engineer in order to engineer these heists. So it's kind of a one night stand thing he has with this woman where he's a little vulnerable for a bit after at once feeling like kind of a jerk. He's paranoid. So when she asks him about himself and stuff, he's kind of rude to her and then realizes that she's no threat to him. So he kind of indulges the company for the time being. And then you think that might be that. But then later on when him and the rest of his crew are getting together and having food and they've all got their wives and stuff, he's the only loner. He's the only guy on his own. And he kind of can just sort of see them all kind of laughing and smiling and having families and things. And it kind of gets him. And so he goes and makes a call to her, and he goes back. He didn't let her go. He wants to meet her again and go out with her again and all that. So now he's kind of starting to form an attachment with this woman, while Pacino and his crew are on to them, and they basically are there. And that's one of my favorite scenes and musical moments, too, especially is this shot of when all the guy, when the... the crew comes out and they're getting their cars, and then you cut to Pacino and his whole crew of guys looking down at him from under, across the the neon signs from like Chinatown or whatever, and then it's just like, so who's this, and they're just they're on to him now, and they talk explaining how they've got their cars set up and everything, and it's like a cool little like moment of cat and mouse, literally, with the way it's staged, with the elevation and everything, them looking down at them and not kind of being...
And how they reverse that?
Yeah, later on, yeah, they reverse that. Not too far after that, the parallelism in this film is not trying to be particularly subtle, I don't think, and I think that's fine. You pretty much cut to the cops and all their wives hanging out, laughing, goofing off, within 10 minutes of this other scene, to see, like, it's not a, maybe they aren't so different after all things so much as it's a, there's one crew that you know, this is how people are, you know? You know, you have your people that you hang out with, your friends and your colleagues and stuff. People like to just have a good time, have a few drinks and tell some stories and so on and so forth. And, of course, Pacino is called away. And I think this is critical because, like you said, the Wayne Grow character is brought back in. And we see that he's a bit of a psychopath. He's not just a fucking idiot, white trash loser. He's killed a prostitute, like a 16-year-old or something. Did they say it? Did they actually put the age to it? And she is young, like kind of gross young.
Yeah, she's 16.
Yeah. And Pacino shows up to be part of all that. And then there's a scene that I think a lot of cynical people, and especially considering it was, you know, 16 years ago, with the music and everything, when the mother finds out that this is, you know, that's her daughter or something, and tries to go and see her, and Pacino kind of stops her and catches her and holds her and hugs her and continues to kind of just absorb all of this kind of heavy emotional stuff. And it doesn't play schmaltzy, because that's not really what it is, but it is a lot. And the fact of the matter is that the truth is that is a lot. So it's not an inauthentic scene, I don't think. I don't think it's overly sentimental or anything like that. Like I said,
the whole
film is stylized. Well, I mean, just to the point where, like, it's like, this is not a bigger deal than it is. This is a big fucking deal. And it's important that we see him doing this because it shows that he's not one of the callous, like a callous cop that has no emotion. It shows that he's not, I mean, Michael Mann talks about this too. I am kind of parroting some of the commentary in this review. But it's only because it makes logical sense when he just says it. If I disagreed with it in places, I would, you know, bring up what I think is different. And I might get to that here in a bit.
Yeah, I almost kind of want to watch it now.
Right, I know, right? It's like you could almost watch the movie again. But just he just takes all of that. And you really get... And then, of course, he goes and he has the scene with his wife, who talks about, like, how was it? And, you know, what was it? And he's like, I don't want to talk about it. And she's like, you don't let me in, and I need to be part of your life. And then he goes big and tells her about, you know, babies being microwaved and all kinds of really gruesome types of shit. And she's like, well, what's your deal there, you know?
What did she say? I guess the world ended.
Yeah, right. That's what she says. Yeah. And, because she's kind of indignant about the fact that he had to go from this party they were all having. And he was the only one that left. All the other guys stayed. Or most of them did, because one of them should have brought her home, but didn't. I mean, there's a little hints of realistic stuff in terms of how people negotiate their relationships in their world. And, yeah. One petty thing about the framing in that shot, though. You get Pacino talking about why he doesn't want to just let everything out. Why he doesn't want to, like, have a cathartic moment with her and just hug and cry about this terrible thing he sees. You know, yeah. He needs to hold on to his angst to keep him sharp, on edge, where he needs to be. Yeah. And he's snapping. But the way the shot is framed, it cuts off his hand. So the snap, like, even if it was a real audio, and I'm sure it was, it sounds awkward. And it's like, why would you go with a take? I mean, maybe he did that on the fly, and they weren't framed for that. And that happens, you know. The actor just decides he's going to snap when he says this. And he probably wasn't in the script, and it probably was not something they were anticipating when they framed, like I said, when they framed it. And so it was out of frame, and it was probably a really good performance, and so they just had to go with it, and it's as good as it is. But it's one of those things that in a movie this good, and this movie is high-end, like this is, you know, triple plus level film, it just is like, ah...
It'd be in my top five.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's just like, fuck, why is the framing off in that shot? And I'm getting worse about that stuff. I'm getting, as I'm starting to move more into, like, wanting to write movies and things, it's all about story logic, and I really can pick shit apart, and which is another reason why, I was talking about that whole thing about Val Kilmer's character's wife cheating on him and the logic of that and the way that all makes sense. And that there's a story there, you can just quickly intuit. Like, you can just quickly figure out, without knowing too much or hearing a whole bunch of exposition, this is probably what happened, and now I understand that, and it makes sense to me, and it makes the world feel more real. Okay, so at this point, I want to say in the story, you get the heist. You get the next score that the crew's going for. They show up at this metal place late at night. And it's a great fucking shot. Oh, man, it's a good shot of L.A. It's helicopter shot, starts up high in the city, and then pans down, and then moves in and follows this truck. So, once again, it completely puts you in the environment. Like, you know, L.A. at 3 o'clock in the morning in January or something like that. And the cops are all there in the waiting. They're set up in a back of a truck, quietly sitting there with their surveillance. They got, it wouldn't be infrared, would it? Is that what that one camera is? Something like that. You know, body heat, predator vision kind of thing.
That'd be infrared, yeah.
Yeah. It was something like that. And, you know, the crew shows up and they start doing their thing. They trick the alarms and they pop open the lock and they go and start drilling through a vault to steal some stuff. And De Niro's just hanging out in the alley, just kind of being the lookout, I guess, presumably, on this job. And some... And this is based on true stuff, too. I guess the Hannah character in real life, they'd set up a sting on an operation for the McNeil character, whatever the character, and that happened, where some dipshit cop like shuffled, and the special features he's talking about, like, you know, when you're on one of these things, you may just be sitting somewhere for hours on end, and you do not move, you don't make any noise, and that happened in real life, and the guy walked away. That's a degree of professionalism on the part of the thieves, is that they just have that discipline to be like, something's not right here, we're gonna leave. And that's what happens with De Niro. It's a great moment of tension, and just the way it's shot is great. How you get, you know, the cop sits down and bumps the back of the trailer, and that they're all in, and De Niro hears it, and it's just Pacino and De Niro, and you cut to back and forth to each of them, and you get the shot that's the IR shot of De Niro, kind of just a cool image, and then he's like, nope, and he's like, we're walking, and he goes and tells the crew, and they get out, and it's like, it'd be a bullshit breaking and entering beef. So Pacino has the discipline not to bust him, and has to argue with some of the other cops that are there about it. And then he gets that moment of being pissed off about the whole thing, and is like, back to work, you know? That's what you gotta do. That's the hunt, that's the discipline, that's the score. And, I guess at some point, then he tries to reconnect with his wife, pretty soon at this point, and he shows up, and she's getting herself all made up, like she's going out somewhere, and she's pretty dejected.
Where are we going?
Yeah, where are we going? And then
where are you going?
Yeah, where are you going? And he goes, okay, fine. We've already had a few scenes with him and his wife that just kind of indicate that he is so busy, he gets so focused. I mean, but like any kind of person that I think has a career that is maybe the perfect career for them, the danger is that they don't have real downtime. Or when they do, they're not particularly fun to be around. Like an artist, even, or someone. Like, when they're fully involved in what they're involved in, they don't want you around them. You can't be around them. You can't really be part of their life in terms of, you know, like a romantic relationship or anything like that. And I think that's very true. I mean, that is sort of the danger when you're pursuing something of your own interest, is, well, how willing am I to completely alienate myself from other people? Because that can happen. You know, you get involved in doing what you really do well, and you're operating at a different level. Most people just don't get that and can't tolerate that. And that's basically what's happened with Hannah his whole life. He's, as a cop, he just gets so... He's all about just hunting the criminal and going after the criminal, and that makes long hours and late nights and not being at home and not being at recitals or not being at all the bullshit of life that is a domestic, regular person with a regular 9-to-5 type job, you know? It's like Batman, Michael Keaton. You know how most people, they get up and go downstairs, they kiss a wife, and they go to work, and yeah, you know, That's not what I do, you know?
They go to ball games.
You go to ball games and they, you know...
Barbecue.
Barbecue and on the weekends and things. And that's just... I mean, you get that, sure, he does do some of that. And he does have off nights. And that, or, you know, and that was one of them. You know, he was ready to go out with her. He was like, you know... Cause that, and that, I think, is very real, too. That whole... It's not even about... If you're so busy all the time that the other person in your life can never do anything with you, it's that you're busy and then you're free and then they're busy or they want to do their own thing. And in that case, that's what's happening. And so she's going to go out and do her own thing that night and he's going to sit there and be bored at home, wash dishes or something. Fuck that. He's not going to wash dishes. He's restless. He's lonely and restless and he wants to go.
Oh, that's when he tracks down.
That's when he tracks down De Niro. He just, you know, he has enough clout and whatever, and he's on a chopper, and he's like, where is he? Where is he at? Get me a car. And he jumps on the freeway, and it's an awesome chase thing, you know. It's the Moby cover of the Joy Division song, New Dawn Fades, which I got to see live with elements of Joy Division playing it at the Area 1 tour back down in L.A. years ago. It was, it was Moby did it with a bunch of the guys from New Order because they were part of the tour too, and like John Frusciante and stuff. I think Billy Corgan was also playing with New Order at the time. It was a good performance. I remember my friend Bill turned to me while we were watching it and he was like, you can just kill me now. Like, that's probably as good as it's ever going to get.
It's as good as it's ever going to get.
Yeah. That was probably the happiest I'd ever seen him.
Whatever happened to Bill?
Bill's still around. Bill's hanging. He's in the Bay Area. He's got a lady friend, and he's got a job. You know, he's computer stuff. So Bill's going to be okay. Bill's doing well, I think. So, hey, Bill, if you're listening to the final podcast, part A.
Nice to... Well...
Right. You remember
only,
Mark.
It's only been...
A long time. He probably will never forget the trip that we took up to Brookings or whatever to meet Nicole. Him and Daniel and I were in that car, and then I had to drive your car back. It was a weird trip. We just wanted to go to the beach for like an hour, right. And it ended up being an all day kind of thing. Anyway, that's a digression we don't need to be involved in right now. But so the New Dawn Fades music is rocking out. And you don't really know what's going to happen at this point. It's like, is he at his wit's end? Is he really just going to go after him? Is he just going to pull him over and be like, look, we're coming to get you? Oh, but it's critical to know that he didn't do this until after he knew that they were onto them. So this is not his way of telling, of kind of brashly confronting and unprofessionally confronting the criminal to let him know that they're onto him. Because that happened already. Yeah. I missed that part. I forgot about that scene.
I brought it up.
You mentioned it, but in context, that once De Niro's people walk away from that score, they go to another location, which is like this docks, and they're talking about a score that we haven't heard anything about in the script yet. So we're kind of like, oh, this sounds like something clever and cool and interesting. It's going to involve boats maybe or something like that. And I remember the first time I saw it, I was like game for whatever the score was going to be. I thought this is going to be something really involved and cool. And then, Pacino's people go down and later on and they're like checking out, trying to figure out, well, what exactly do you think they were talking about? Like, what are they doing? And Pacino kind of smiles and is like, oh, they were checking us out because now we're here and they're probably watching us. And they were. And that's how De Niro got some pictures of the cops that were watching him so he can get his info on them. You know, it kind of works both ways. Now the criminals need to know the cops that are chasing them. You know, it's the cops and robber duality, you know. I'm going to know what I can about you and try to find your weakness. And you're going to know what you can about me and find my weaknesses. And so, yeah, so after that scene had happened, now you get Pacino knowing that they're on to them, and he's just gonna go have a chat with him. So he pulls him over, and you see De Niro got the gun under the seat, ready to go. Like, if this is gonna have to rock and roll, he's gonna have to rock and roll. You know, he'll shoot that cop right then and there and pull off and just do what he can. He's close to the airport, too. Which is because he was going to ditch the car. And So they go have their cup of coffee at kind of a crowded diner. And the lens choice, of course, is a shallow depth of field, so that that way the background people are not particularly distracting. But it's very populated. It's not a booth. It's a chair with two tables. I mean, it's a table with two chairs in the midst of a busy diner at like 8:30 at night or something like that. And they have their little conversation where they kind of confront each other, and then they kind of connect, and they kind of measure, take each other's measure, and they're probably the most vulnerable and open to each other in that scene than they are to anybody else in the film. And I mean, you know, it's pretty much, I mean, it's like
that was probably the weakest moment for me in the movie.
Really? The conversation is the weakest moment for you?
I love that scene, but some of the dialogue I really don't understand.
Some of it is a little weird. Yeah, to a degree. I mean,
it's just a little unrealistic, and it's a little too contrived.
I don't know. I mean, like when he says, you know, there's a flip side to that coin, like that sounds a little weird.
There's that, and, you know, just a lot of it's repetitive. I mean, just a lot of it doesn't really need to be said. My favorite part in the whole scene, and I love that scene, and that's my favorite part of the score, is that scene, is when they're just staring at each other.
Oh, yeah, no.
That's great, but then, you know, he's going on about, you know, don't take scores and right, all this other shit, and it's...
Well, but you need that.
And
you,
then he's going on about... you know, you do what you do, and I do what I gotta
right,
do.
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't have to do shit. You do it because you love it.
Right.
Whether it's right or wrong, or whether it's good or bad for you, no. That's why you do it.
You do it because...
It's not a sense of duty.
No, yeah. Yeah, you do it because it's what you do. I don't get a sense that De Niro sees it as a sense of duty or anything like that, though.
No, it's not De Niro talking. De Niro doesn't do a lot of the talking. A lot of what comes out of De Niro's mouth really isn't all that interesting.
But that's believable, too, from the character. Because he's talking to a cop. He's not going to volunteer too much. But at some level, he kind of gets comfortable, and he sort of volunteers.
No, but he does volunteer a certain amount. He goes on about his 30-second spiel again.
Right, yeah.
And then he's giving Hannah a bunch of shit about how, you know, if you're going to try to keep up with a guy like me, then how do you expect to, you know, have relationships and all
right,
this
yeah.
other shit? And he's like, well, what are you, a monk?
Mm-hmm.
I got a woman. And yeah. It's no. just... I didn't like the dialogue at all. It just was too unreal.
Well, a lot of the film is stylized. I mean, I'm saying stylized as a nice way, as a PC way, or whatever type of way, to imply, yes, it is contrived. It is a movie. You're right. A lot of it is more believably in characteristic. And I think that, I mean, like, this would be... play-by-play with that, and like I said, I just watched the commentary, so that's the 11th take that they did out of 12, I think. He kept a lot of it because of... I mean, they shot both two cameras, so because of the looks. And a lot of times, he's using the look and not the dialogue because they're doing something that you don't normally like to do from an editing standpoint, which is you're hearing somebody else talk when you're looking at somebody. And they do that a lot in that scene. Because the looks are what's really important. And you see De Niro being very evasive, not really quite meeting his eye that often, or he does, and then he looks away, and he does. And he's quick with his descriptions. Because he feels kind of like he's in a corner. I mean, from De Niro, from his character standpoint, he doesn't know. Maybe he's going to get busted right there for something they might have on him at this point. He doesn't really know. So he's got to be a little guarded and a little aggressive, too, you know, because it's a cop and everything else. And Pacino's doing a little of his over-the-top stuff that he does with his CIs, trying to sort of throw him off. And so there is that sense of, at first, I mean, it kind of plays like an essay in a weird way, where it's like, at first it's the introduction, like, I'm going to take scores, will you do this, well, you shouldn't do that.
Well, you know, and that's just the whole thing, too, is he's not just keeping his mouth shut.
Right.
He is admitting, you know, it's like...
Yeah, he gives him a few nuggets, he gives him the woman, He gives him, you know, that he's got a woman on the side. And you know, he doesn't just say, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not a thief, you know? He just doesn't, I think at that level there's that sort of understanding or something. And that, the scene is totally important because it's like both these characters are what they are, and they're so comfortable being what they are. They're so, like, that complete at that. Man in the commentary, and he makes a point of this many times, differentiating this. He says they're both very ego-centered, which isn't egocentric, but rather, like, they're self-aware to a point where, greater than most of the other characters, they know who they are and what they are as people. And sure, they need a little, you know, they forget it in places, and I mean, that's part of why there's a character arc, or there's fatal flaws within both of them, you know? Pacino shouldn't have probably married that woman, knowing what he really is, which is a cop and a hunter of men, essentially, when he is a cop. He's not a domestic guy, like we've talked about already.
Is he the wolf?
Right. Well, we talked about that a little, too. He's like the wolf a little, in the way that he pursues things, and handles things, and his leadership qualities. But, I mean, yeah, you're right. It's definitely got some stylized bits. Some of the dialogue is a bit much. It's not...
You know, that's really the only scene where the dialogue bothers him.
I think that's because that's what that scene is. That scene is stripped down to just two guys at a table talking, and so you're going to catch the dialogue a lot more. There's nothing flashy happening in the background, or it's the slowest scene in the whole movie too, in terms of pacing. As opposed to everything else, there's something moving. I would say in almost every single shot or scene of the movie, something is moving. If it's not the camera moving through the people, it's the people moving past the camera on some level. Things are just back and forth, and it's very like I said, it's very kinetic. And in that scene, it just stops, and these two guys talk. And it is philosophical. And it is, it is a bit much. I don't think any of it is against character. So it doesn't feel inauthentic in that sense. But it is definitely contrived and a bit convenient in things. Like, and to a degree, I can rationalize all of it. I can rationalize why De Niro would give up the information about him having a woman, or why he would sort of be so defensive about the idea of what he does and who he is. You know, he's not, you know, why he would care what Hannah thinks of him on some level.
Well, Hannah's already boosted his ego a little bit,
right?
You know, when he hears back that, you know, Hannah thinks he's some sort of rock star.
Right, yeah. That scene had also happened before that. Because once De Niro...
He does this sharp, and he does that sharp.
Right, yeah.
Look how sharp this guy is to see that.
Right, yeah. Because De Niro has gotten his information about... Once he knows which cops are following him, he knows all about Hannah. And that's a bit of an exposition-y scene with John Voight, who just tells, you know, lays out that Hannah was a Marine, and then he had two ex-wives, and he's on his third marriage, and he busted a crazy gang in Chicago, and you know, this guy just is a full on kick ass gonna bust people cop. And so we know that De Niro's character knows what kind of person Pacino's getting. But yeah, so I mean, just in terms of the way the writing is paced and the way the scenes fall, It perfectly makes sense. And another thing about the structure of the film, that conversation, them meeting, is pretty much dead center of the film. The film is like 2 hours and 50 minutes long, and it's like an hour and a half into it, and they meet. So a little over halfway, but only a little. And they have their conversation. They know who each other is. They've learned about the other one already through in De Niro's case through paperwork and file.
You know, and that whole part really irritated me too.
What?
When they're talking about what they're going to do if they meet again.
Right. How they, you know, they won't, they'll you know.
You know, I'm not, you know, not going back to prison.
And, right.
And all this crap and Vincent having to go into the fact that, you know, he's not going to like it, but.
Right, yeah.
And all this shit, and I'm just kind of like, you know, we know what's going to happen. We don't need to explain it right here. It's not like they're going to walk up to each other and shake hands in the middle of the bad guys.
But I mean, but it's sort of important that, like, the finality of this meeting and the uniqueness of it, like this is the last time we're ever going to be like this. We've had this little moment, and I think part of that is why they're able to be so vulnerable with each other, because they know that they're not going to, like, have a friendship that goes on. There's going to be no sense of betrayal here, you know?
Yeah, it's not, it is kind of funny. I've found that true. Sometimes it's much easier to be completely honest with people that...
You'll never see again.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And you don't really know.
No, it totally is. I mean, that's kind of what people pay shrinks for. I'm sure that they're accredited to know how to, you know, maybe deal with certain kinds of general problems, but it's also just there's somebody that you don't really know, you know? that you can just tell stuff to, and they're not going to care that, you know, they're not going to be like, oh, you know, that person's talking shit about a friend of ours. It's like, no, that person's just...
You know, it's kind of funny. I think I mentioned to you earlier tonight that I was watching Stephen King interviews the other night, and
right.
Interviewer asked him if he'd ever considered going, if he'd ever been to a psychiatrist. And he's like, no, you know, you pay $90-$100 an hour to tell somebody your fears when I can write them down and people pay me to hear
right.
them.
Right, yeah, exactly. No, that is a funny little anecdote. It's all about venting, basically. Stephen King is talented enough to vent his... Or successful, whether talent is kind of an subjective thing, but his books sell, so a lot of people like him, and he's able to get that out.
I think I'm pretty sure he's over 500 million.
Yeah. So, anyway, yeah, so back to, I agree, but I disagree. Some of those are a little cringeworthy. The coin thing bothers me. That particular line of the conversation with De Niro's, like, delivery and the way that he even says that, you know, is another sign of that coin. But, I mean, but the ineloquence in that is kind of authentic to a criminal, too. Like, it's not like this guy's a fucking poet, you know? He would just kind of try to talk in, like, a weird kind of thin...
You know, but at the same time, he has his moments. It is kind of corny, but it's great.
Yeah.
I'm just talking to an empty telephone.
No, that with Van Zandt, yeah.
Because there's a dead man at the other end of this fucking line.
Right, yeah. Click. Yeah, no, that was good. And that's a very stylized line, too, that he would bother to say all that stuff and be all, like, a tough guy.
But it's fun.
No,
that.
Exactly. And that's the whole point, is that you're watching a contrived...
Because in real life, no, you wouldn't do that unless...
And you'd watch the A&E documentary about the police procedural blah, 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 if you wanted that. That's why, like, TV and movies and things that are contrived are contrived
for really, that guy, his people wouldn't contact him in a day or two. You'd wonder... this isn't good.
Yeah.
This is not good at all.
Right.
And, you know, he'd want to know what happened. And Robert De Niro would just show up on his doorstep one day and put two in his head, and that'd be...
Yeah.
There wouldn't be anything said about it. And that would have worked in the film, too. I mean, you really... It's right. fun, but it'd also be great just... It'd yeah. just be all business.
I am trying to think about that. If they gave a good rationale for why De Niro bothered to call him.
Because he was really, really pissed off about it.
Yeah, I guess it was just that.
He was really, really pissed off about it, and he didn't have time to deal with Van Zandt.
At the time. So
he just wanted to scare the shit out of him.
Yeah, exactly. He probably wasn't going to ever get a chance to deal with him either, maybe. Like you said, he's a luxury. Maybe he would.
No, because that was before they knew the heat was on him. If there hadn't been the heat on him, he probably would have just taken care of it in a day or
right,
two.
Right, yeah. So they have that whole scene, too, where after the conversation, he immediately goes and loses the tail, and all the guys...
I can understand Van Zandt's rationale, because Okay, some people knocked over a armored car.
Yeah, that was the heist at the beginning. Was where they stole the bonds from this Van Zandt guy, who's not a good guy. He runs like drug money.
If you found out the Russian mafia had stolen your shit, you'd probably just let it go.
Right. But, and so in the case of Van Zandt, he's basically a launderer for drug money, you know? Right. An investment guy for that. And he doesn't
want to... Maybe he got started with Pablo.
Doesn't want to appear weak or something. I mean, you get the whole point. He thinks these guys are smaller time than they are. He underestimates them.
Right.
And he hires a shit crew to try to take him out, and those guys are inept. And they get taken out. And that's a big... That's the scene that is at the drive-in.
You know, that always bothered me, too, that Val Kilmer was a little bit off on that.
Right.
I mean, he could have said something a lot sooner than he did.
Right. Yeah. No. Well, it wasn't a perfect execution, but that kind of gave it a little bit of realism, too, or whatever.
And did you ever look up or find out what Val Kilmer's issue was with his arm?
No, and he wasn't in the commentary. I wonder if it's an IMDb trivia thing or not, but yeah, he's got that big old belt on his elbow in a scene earlier on.
That thing was a freaking... That was like a... And he had a freaking... Like baseball hanging.
Yeah,
off
and he's
his
kind
elbow.
Of beat up looking to the point, like facially too. Like there's some makeup effect there too. So either that he really got beat up somehow in life, and they just had to work with it, or it was supposed to be subtext to something he had gone and gotten himself in trouble that night. And
you know, I wonder if it got filmed. I wonder if he'd gotten. There were some stunts, you know. I wonder if I'm not sure.
He could have got
when hurt. The yeah. main heist, the bank heist, got filmed. It's possible that he had gotten hurt.
Yeah, it is possible. You'd think that they would work to kind of cut it out because it's so prominent. It's something that you really see. And so it begs the question is the problem. And so I figure it's something that they must have wanted.
I wonder if I'm sure there are podcasts about people talking about their pets. You don't want that.
Yeah.
It's very bad for you.
No. But we're not going to do that. We got a little out of focus there talking about Kilmer's injuries in a scene earlier on when he goes to De Niro's place to crash because he's having trouble with his old lady. And De Niro, of course, is the
ass. His old lady.
Needs to make it all work.
With Hank Azaria's head all the way up it.
Yeah.
Didn't really get into that a whole lot.
No, they were going to work Hank Azaria as another, the police work, because they knew that... Once they knew the guys, they knew their wives, they could just connect. I mean, everybody had strings that they could be pulled on because they had these connections that De Niro didn't have. He was the loner. He was the unknown.
And he was the last one that they had found, too.
Right, yeah. And so,
And they never did find Amy Brenneman.
No, not really, because she was new and really, uninvolved with him to a degree. They'd, you know... been together a few times, but so they dump the tails, they have one last conversation about taking this bank score that sounds like a pretty good deal. It was 10 million?
It was 12.2 million.
Right, yeah. You know, seemingly modest, but for 95, pretty good, and sort of had a realism to it, which is a nice number.
Well, know? Split four ways.
Yeah. And then, you know...
That's 3 mil.
Yeah. I'm not going to bat an eyelash about it. And that's when that's where the choice element comes in. I mean, Mann talks about that as a big part of the story, too, is all these characters... are dealing. I mean, it isn't a story about fatalism. It's a story about people being in situations where they have to make choices, and that scene is perfect. De Niro says, "Look, it's worth a stretch to me." He's looking to get out. He doesn't have enough time. He wants to have enough time to do what he really wants to do. Now, we don't even really ever know what that is. We know he fancies the idea of going to New Zealand. You know, just living there, and who knows what, living out his days. Maybe he wants to, I don't know, own a boat and sail around the Great Barrier Reef or something. I don't, but it doesn't matter. We just know that he's not living the life that he necessarily wants to be living, but he's very close to that. And he started to make this connection with this woman. He started to let himself make connections because he's starting to enter that stage of retirement. And it's the same trope you get with any kind of hitman story, generally, to a large extent, where you get the hitman burned out. He's ready to not be this cold sociopath anymore. He's ready to start forming human connections. And that's generally what the arc is for most hitman stories. Something as ridiculous as Bangkok Dangerous or as comedic as Gross Point Blank. In the case of The Mechanic, it's more like a guy passing the torch. I've seen both of them, yeah.
Oh, great.
Right.
I didn't realize you'd finally seen that.
No.
But the end is great.
Well, yeah.
Michael Vincent.
Endgame.
Yep.
Chicken licking is licking chicken.
So you finally saw the scene with the chick who commits suicide.
I love that scene.
That is so wicked.
That is so good. Yeah, you might be able to, he just tosses her the keys. But, okay, so it's the sociopathic criminal kind of starting to have a humanistic awakening with De Niro's character. So that is his motivation. Is like, this is the last score. It's worth it to me. I'm going to try to make this work. Which is another case of him being breaking his ethos. You know, he's getting emotionally attached to these things and this idea of being free of this. You end up with Sizemore's character, who De Niro basically lays it out to him, like, you shouldn't do this. You have a family. He has, like, holdings. He has, like, funds and money in the real life.
But that's not why he
does it for the score. The score is the juice, he says. And so he's clearly operating from an emotional standpoint of just a absolute career criminal. Like, I rob the bank because it's my job. That's my job. What do you mean? I kind of do what I do for a living, which is rob banks. Kilmer's character is very much so driven by, a kind of almost paternal component with De Niro's character, where it's like, well, if you're going to do it, I'm going to do it because I'm on board with you. That's what I do. I do what you do. And you get a little of that hinted at earlier in the way that De Niro calls up his wife and...
Well, no, Val Kilmer has to do it because he's broke.
Right, yeah, that is that.
Tom
yeah.
Sizemore is more following Neil's lead.
Right, and then Trio is just kind of, you know, he's there. He's the wheel man. He's like, you know, I'm with it, of course, you know?
Fuck it, sure.
That's what I do. And so then they've all made their choices. They're all going to do what they're going to do. And
Me, again, we were talking about that tonight with the movie we'll watch tonight.
Right.
That when you have enough, just cut it clean.
But it's gambling, it's everything else. It's right. Go back for one more, or are we good? You know? I'm good. I can get away with this, I think. And, yeah. So, that's the situation that they're in, and... And as far as Al Pacino's character is concerned, he's at a loss. They don't know what they're doing next, and they don't know how things are going. But the whole Van Zant situation
should have taken care of
is still going on. And lo and behold, Wayne Grove shows up, and
Wayne Grove doesn't seem like he'd be that hard to find.
Right, Wayne Grove has a connection to these guys, and Wayne Grove has a certain brutality to him, and he's gonna help Van Zant screw these guys over.
It wasn't the smartest move for Wayne Grove either.
Or Van Zant. No, it wasn't.
Or Van Zant.
Wayne Grove should have GTFO'd.
And Wayne Grove should have figured that, because Wayne Grove should have gotten out of town, because he should have realized if anybody got word of where he was at, he was probably gonna be 86.
Right, but you get the sense that he thinks he's like a big deal, you know, that the way he talks to that guy.
Wayne Grove is Kevin.
Yeah, he's a psychopath.
He
doesn't think he can be killed, maybe. Yeah.
Maybe he's not the smartest of criminals.
No. He's talking about being in Pelican Bay in Folsom, and he's a cowboy looking for action, you know? I mean...
Well, he was in the shoe.
Right.
He talks about being in the shoe. So he's a problem.
Right.
Exactly. What the hell... oh, shit, what's his head? solitary housing unit. Something housing unit. But basically, it's solitary.
Right, yeah. It's just another term for it.
It's like death row. You're, like, locked down 23 hours a day. And when they let you out in the shoe, you don't get to go outside. I think they have this, this concrete room that has...
It's like open, so
that has sunlight. Windows, I think, where you can see the sky, but and you get to walk, you get to pace around that for an hour. It's not a good place to be. In fact, if you're in it for years, it sounds like it drives most people crazy.
I would think so. Yeah,
but yeah, not fun.
No, poor Wayne Grow, victim of the system.
Victim of the system,
which they do get into later.
Oh, with Dominic.
With Dominic, yeah. So these guys are looking to implement their score.
Man, that is so weird. He's talking about Chino and Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was stuck in Chino when it was really strange. It was just one of those really bizarre moments. It was like January. But the weather in Chino was like 80 degrees. It was a beautiful day. It was really strange, and I got stuck. My truck broke down at this Home Depot in Chino, and there was like this boutique restaurant across the street, and I went and paid like $20 for 4 tacos. And so, they were really good, though.
Well, I guess it was worth it. $5 taco.
Yeah, what they had, the Mai tacos and shit, and I think I got chicken.
Not too bad.
Yeah.
So that's your Chino story.
That was my Chino
story. About being in Chino in solitaire.
Yeah.
So De Niro and his crew, they're good to go. They're going to take this bank, and you got the force marker. Brian Eno music is going. They walk in. They're pros. They handle their weapons well. They lay out the security.
Talk about the most sympathetic character in the
right,
movie.
Right, right. I was kind of going to get to that as we arrived to it.
Okay.
So they're getting ready to take the score before the Brian Eno music and all that, and they're missing a dude. Trio hasn't shown up. He gives him a fucking call and says, like, he can't get the heat off of him. And you're a little suspect at this point, but at the same time, you're like, oh, okay. And it's like a zero-hour fuck situation. And De Niro is pretty pissed off about it. He almost slams the phone in the middle of this diner, but doesn't. A lot of diners in this movie. Because it's set in a real world. And just so happens that he sees Dennis Hasbert, who's man in the grill behind this diner. And you've seen 2 or 3 scenes of this character, and they're completely isolated scenes. They're head scratchers up until this point. They're just like, is this just supposed to be some way to point to, like, oh, it's an ex-con who's getting, you know, victimized by an employer, you know, who's basically like, you know, you give me 25% of what you make, or I say the, you know, I send you back to jail. I say that you fucked up and you're going back to jail. And so Des Hasbert is basically kind of
oppressed. That was another thing that I was wondering about in the whole heist scene. So he's watching the scanner. They never get word that anything has gone out about that, and there's a million fucking cops waiting for him.
Right.
So you'd think you would have heard something over the scanner. It's not like they could have done it all, especially back in those days.
Right, yeah. No, that could be a possible flaw. I don't know. I think the cops would have been wise to that. They would have been like, you know what? Let's not put this out. I mean, I don't know if they say anything in the movie, if it's super quick or not. Plus, it starts as Pacino's just group, and then once the weapons come out, then the other cops show up very quickly. So the word might have come out, like, right as it was. You know, I don't know. There's various rationale. And he might not have even had the scanner. Maybe Trio had the scanner, and, I mean...
No, because he mentions it when he asks.
And, oh, right, yeah, man the scanner and the wheels or something like that. Anyway, so that's kind of an aside. But,
Now, there are channels that they can use that are private.
Okay. So, Hasbert's character has just been kind of in a tough situation, and he's got a wife that... that kind of cares about him and is proud of him.
Well, we don't know if it's his wife.
Well, he's got an old lady to tell
him. He's got an old lady who has a 1970 Camaro.
That's his.
Oh, that's his?
You know, I thought when I was rewatching it with the commentary and everything, I was like, this seems so strange that his wife would have a car like this. And then you realize, well, if he's a wheel man, he's a car guy. It's his car. And the great humiliation is that as a car guy, his wife has to drive
El Camino.
His wife has to drive him to this diner where he's going to work because he's an ex-con now. He probably doesn't have his license yet, or maybe he can't get his license yet, or at the very least, he doesn't have multiple cars or whatever. So I'm fairly certain that's his car.
And all of the vehicles on that side of things, that crew and extended crew,
mm-hmm.
are all General Motors.
Okay, then.
They're all Cadillacs. They're all Chevrolets.
Right.
Yeah, they're all Cadillacs or Chevrolets. You got the Camaro. You got the two new Camaros at the end. You had the Cadillacs, and you got the El Camino.
Well, there you go. Know your cars.
And then on the cop side of things, it's... I thought that was kind of odd. The two cars that Pacino drives are both Fords. I always thought that was kind of strange, too.
Well, I mean... Who knows? Maybe it's weird commentary. I doubt it. It's probably just that they get a certain agreement with companies, and the companies are like, oh, yeah, whatever, you know. Who knows? They probably decide what kind of cars fit the character first, and then it either falls down that way or it doesn't. I don't know if they were that big on product placement so much on that level at that point. It's possible they had an agreement, but who knows? It's probably something in between. You know, like, well, this character would drive this kind of car, okay, it happens to be this company. And this character would drive that kind of car, well, it happens to be this company, you know. Who knows? So, at the last moment, and this is the choice thing again, and man says this about this scene specifically, like, that's how life is, you know? Someone offers you a choice right then and there. Right now, I need an answer. You gonna go left, you gonna go right? You wanna take the job, or do you wanna not take the job? Is this a great opportunity that will change your life? Or is this a terrible opportunity you should be disciplined enough to walk away from?
Well, I think it's an equal cut.
Oh, yeah, no shit. For doing an hour's worth of work, and now he's good and he doesn't need this fucking shit job with the diner or whatever.
Yeah, he'd have to skip out on parole.
Right, yeah, he'd have all kinds of real problems he's not thinking about at that moment, at that shitty Tuesday morning when he's been at this place for months and it's just...
You're in situations where you're that miserable.
Right.
And you start thinking of ways out.
Just doing something else, you know? It doesn't matter. So, exactly. It's relatable, which is why you said he's very sympathetic. Because he's trying to do the right thing. He's never... We've never seen him be a criminal. We just know that he's a parolee that's trying to do the right thing. He's got to go with the shit that he's been handed. But
there isn't a hard time that's been invented that he cannot handle.
Right, exactly. And so... He goes and agrees to be the driver, and then they hit the bank. And
you know, I take that back. That fucks it all up.
What?
They're driving a Lincoln.
Well, there you go then. See, it's to the characters, or it's to the mentality, or it's to the visual thing. This movie's one of those movies that doesn't have a lot of stuff that just happenstance in it. It's well planned and well thought out. And, so they rob the bank, but Pacino's people are just sitting at the office, doing work, working cases, because they got more than one case to work. And somebody comes in and says, "Hey, you guys are following a crew onto this random tip." Oh my God, Deus Machina! Not really, though, because this movie's complex enough that it's laid all the pieces in such that you're like, "Okay, well, how do they get the tip? What's going on?"
Wayne grows behind it.
Well, we learn that, but we don't really know that as a viewer yet, and that puts us in a situation. But we don't really care either at that moment because what it does is it facilitates the cops arriving in time to bust these guys, which then creates a massively insane, like, war movie style assault in the middle of downtown LA with squibs and. You know, Bondo blowing off cars and shit.
Lots of squibs.
Lots of squibs, lots of gunfire.
I always thought that was really fascinating, too, how they did that. They were very authentic.
With the car stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in the commentary talks, how they did that is they went, they drove those cars out to the range, they shot them full of holes, they bondoed them over with squibs, and then popped the squibs. I don't know how they did, like, the corners of buildings in the actual location. That would be a little curious. But, yeah, it's, like I said, part of it being made in 16 years ago is that, it, sure, it's more stylized, and maybe there's some parts that might read as hokey nowadays, but it's also, like, practical effects stuff and shit, you know? They didn't...
Practical effects is so much better.
Oh, absolutely.
But I don't... After I...
It costs more, that's why. And it's illegal in places.
Well, I thought that was... thought that wasn't necessarily true, because I was curious about that, but...
Well,
apparently all that CG shit is expensive.
Some of it is, and to a degree, but relative to what, you know what I mean? In terms of...
Well, relative to what? If you're making a shitty movie...
Right, yeah, right.
It's like you're going to be remembered forever for being shit.
Right. And so... you don't have to win me over here. I agree, but I do understand that from certain standpoints, just from a production standpoint, a time is money kind of standpoint and everything else, they have to make those decisions. Or they do, or they push that, and I wouldn't. I would always fight for practical. But this gunfight is just, you get the real sound, the real production audio of this just vicious, horrific sound of these guns going off, echoing through the city.
Crazy.
And it's almost too much. Like, I've seen the movie a few times, and
I remember the theater was too much. I mean,
right, yeah.
You practically had to cover your ears.
Yeah, they turned it up, you said. It was when THX was first coming out, and they would all turn, all the theaters were turned up about 50% higher than they needed to be, and that was supposed to be the awesome thing. It's like, it's too fucking loud. So yeah, they're shooting guns.
Well, that was really interesting, too. Was it the Marines that used that Val Kilmer's?
Yes, in the special features they talk of, Kilmer makes the joke about how in the Marine Corps they showed the clip from Heat where I change rounds, I change magazines or whatever, not rounds, but magazines, and they're like, if you can't do that as fast as this actor can, you know, then you're a piece of shit. So I think it's just a funny thing that they do. So, but all the training the actors had, all this professional training about how to handle firearms properly and stuff, it all adds to the realism of the picture and to the whole effect. And so it's just an awesome scene. And of course, quickly and unceremoniously, Dennis Haspert's taken out by the police, just shot up, and he's done for. And you get Tom Sizemore.
I don't know why I nod.
Right. You get Tom Sizemore. Well, you're interacting with me.
Yeah, that's true. If you're really here.
Tom Sizemore and Kilmer and De Niro were just getting out of the dead car and just moving because more assets, as man calls it, are being called in. More police are being called in at all times to just take these guys out because it turns into something crazy big deal. And it's you know, it's staged the way it's staged, and people get, you know, Ted Levine's character gets killed. He's wearing his jacket, but, you know, a jacket doesn't do shit if you get shot in the neck. And that's what happens to him, and he's boom, and it's gruesome, and he's dead.
It doesn't do shit if you get shot with the wrong thing, too.
Right. And Kilmer gets nipped, but doesn't get killed, and De Niro ends up carrying him off, and Sizemore ends up on his own, and running through, tripping in a fountain, and picking up a little girl. And we talked about this when we watched it, about
his motivations
for that. Now, man is pretty clear and explicit in his commentary that he's as a criminal, he has his family and his people that he cares about, but this girl is someone he would just use. He says he's using her as a hostage, which is a perfectly valid argument. My only, like, concern, or I guess with that, it's just the way that Sizemore's character behaves towards her when he first picks her up. How he seems a little bit fatherly towards her, and you get that he had a daughter. So a part of me wants to think that it's believable that the way that it's framed with this girl essentially being in the line of fire and the crossfire is that he's picking her up to get her out of that, to move her away quickly and doesn't have quite the chance.
Well, he's not necessarily using her as a shield.
He doesn't really use her as a shield particularly. I mean, it's not explicitly or hokey in that sense, yes. The first time I watched it, I immediately was like, fuck this guy, he's using a little girl as a shield. Or he's using a little girl as a hostage. And so, yeah, but this time not... I mean, but the fact that it's open to that interpretation despite what the director says, because who knows what the actor thought at that moment that he made that, did that bit of performance that got me thinking about that, you know? I mean, that happens all the time.
Was he met that yet?
Hmm? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he was in 95. I think in the special features he seems a little out of it, and that was, you know, years later. But I mean, that's, you know, that's just what's there, is there's a bit of interpretation there.
Let me guess, De Niro didn't do any of the special features, did he? Because he almost never does.
They had interview from 1995, so he right. It was like, he did press for the movie when the movie happened and talked about the character and stuff, so there was that. But it wasn't, like, recent stuff. I think most of the other ones had maybe somewhat more recent interview stuff. But there wasn't a huge amount, to be honest, either. I mean, there was enough. But with a movie like that, you'd almost could have like an entire like feature-length documentary about the making of that movie, instead of just like six featurettes that amounts to like 40 minutes or whatever. So yeah, so Sizemore's got this little girl. It's a very tense situation, and Pacino, who we know has absorbed all of this emotion, he's not a cold killer. He's not a jaded cop that has no concern for things. He's a guy that.
Really? I don't think he gave him an opportunity to drop his weapon and turn himself in.
No, well, that was not the circumstances they were in, though, either. He gets a bead on him and he shoots him in the head. The audacity and the confidence and the intensity and the angst and all that other thing, all those other things that go into that, knowing that what you know about that Pacino character, that he's got that emotionally. He cares about that little girl. He's not like, that little girl doesn't mean shit to me. I'm just gonna. I'm all about taking the bad guys out. I'm a cowboy. I'm whatever. He's concerned. He cares about people.
Wayne Grove describes himself as a cowboy.
Right. Exactly. and he just, you know, and so that moment is super crazy intense. How he just takes out Sizemore. So Sizemore's character, boom, he's done. His storyline is now ended. Haspert's character is done. His storyline is now ended.
Sort of. There's one last scene where he's with the woman. With the woman.
That sees it and cries, and yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of scenes.
Now has a Camaro, apparently, since you thought that it was his.
Well, she would still have the car that was their car or whatever. I'm fairly certain that it was his car. I'm not like she went out and bought it. You know what I mean? Like, as a wheelman, he was like a guy that would be into cars or whatever. That makes sense to me. Because it's another thing you intuit. So now you're seeing the aftermath. The aftermath of this whole situation happening. De Niro's character's still on the run. Chris's character's still on the run. Ashley Judd has called up the guy she's been cheating on with, and says, you know what, I'm out of here, come get us, we are leaving this guy, and we are going to live with you now, you know, you're my new sugar daddy, you know, basically. Amy Brenneman's character, who now knows that De Niro is what he is, that he's been lying to her about being like a metal salesman or whatever, and he has to kind of restrain her, and because he cares about her, and his life is only worth living if it's with her, that kind of shit. She kind of is sort of dead to it, and kind of, like, detached from it all, and kind of agrees to be with him and go with him, despite herself in some sense. And Pacino shows up to see that his wife has cheated on him, and he's done. That relationship is done, so he takes the only possession that's his in the whole house.
I never cheat on you, bitch.
Yep, and takes the TV
and
walks out, and that's, you know, everything's kind of collapsed for everybody. I mean, both the cops have suffered their losses. One of them is dead, another one got clipped, and, you know, the robbers have suffered their losses, and De Niro has to know who sold them out, basically, because they had the alarms under control, so somebody must have sold them out, and, you know, the only guy that wasn't there that knew about it was Danny Trejo, so... Following the logic of the story, he goes to talk to Danny Trejo and encounters him having been tortured and basically in a really gruesome scene, you know? I mean, he's, you know, shot in the head or something must have happened where he's barely alive on the ground. And he lets De Niro know that it was Wayne Grow, and Wayne Grow knew about him and came...
Van Zandt.
With Van Zandt, sort of, as a motivator. And, tortured his wife and tortured him and got the information about what they were doing. And they were the ones that called it in through the informant, another CI that was here at Henry Rollins. So that's the angle that the police take, is that they go after the CI. They go after Henry Rollins. Pacino beats him up a little bit for kind of a general venting process of what's this all about, you know? And that gets them rolling on the whole situation. They learn about
Wayne Grove. I know, it's kind of funny what a piece of shit he thinks he is.
Right, yeah. They learn about Wayne Grove and they learn about Trejo. And they go and they see that Trejo has been taken out, you know? De Niro beat them to Trejo by... probably by like an hour or something. And Pacino.
No, why are they Van Zandt?
Right, that's right. He beats into Van Zandt too. Because he goes and takes out Van Zandt. But Van Zandt doesn't know where Wayne Grove is. He's gotten a lot, gotten a lot of this information.
I don't think that's what would have came out of my mouth from that particular moment.
Well, you know what? It fits for the character.
It did.
It completely, because he almost sounded like a little, like, petulant kid that's never lost anything in his life, being like, what are you doing here? I thought I won. No, what do you mean, you know, like, don't kill me. You know, but yeah, there's no really time for that.
He really didn't do any of that either.
Well, there's no time for that, but he was basically at that level, you know? He you know, he's about to start bawling when he says, how would I know?
I didn't get that.
Oh, you don't get that? What, do you think he's being a tough guy about it?
No.
He's not being a tough guy. He's a whiny little bitch at that point.
Yeah, but he didn't really come across like a whiny little bitch either. He seems like he's...
I'm just talking about that scene at the end.
No, I know exactly what you're saying. He seems like he's in shock.
Well, there's that too. He thought he was good. He was sitting there watching the hockey, taking it easy in his jammies for the first time home after like a week. He'd been living out of his office, scared shitless that these guys were going to take him out at any point, which...
Yeah, it's definitely kind of in shock because the chair goes through the window, the sliding glass doors.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he's done for. Yeah, real arrogance and oversight, which fits his character too. Not having... bodyguards at his place for like the next week or two, not paying attention to the news, you know.
Yeah, like he couldn't invite Henry Rollins over to watch the hockey game.
Right, yeah. So Van Zandt gets taken out, so his story is now done. You have Chris's story still, and Ashley Judd's story, and Ashley Judd finds out that Hank Azaria has been in on it with the cops, and then you get Michael T. Williams talking about in a great scene with Ashley Judd, just basically laying out like how her kid hasn't had a choice to make the career criminal situation, and talking about how that's how it goes. If his life goes a certain way where he's in fucking foster care because she's an accessory because she doesn't help them bring in Val Kilmer's character.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine today about that and different people that we've come across in different lines of work that
right.
grew up in really... around hardcore criminals.
Right.
And how they almost didn't really have a chance. It's not like there really was a choice.
No, it's like that's the life.
Yeah. And they weren't necessarily bad people. They just, you know...
did what came natural.
Yes.
And, I mean...
did what they knew.
Well, you know, you think about it, though. Be honest about it. There's always, you know... how often do you see the son that does what his dad did for a living? You know, my brother is a printer, and my dad was a printer, and his dad was a printer. You know, you hear about the cop thing all the time, you know?
Yeah, you know,
my dad was a cop, my grandfather was a cop, and I'm a cop, you know? And people follow what they... I mean, there's a genetic thing, there's a nature-nurture thing, there's a lot of human behavior shit going on there about that sort of stuff. So people either react against or they fall into what their kind of parents and what their environment breeds.
I knew a guy that kept saying he was a sixth-generation truck driver, and it always had me scratching my head.
Yeah, right.
But he wasn't just the brightest.
Who knows?
Or the sharpest.
Or, you know, the guy was ox cart.
Wouldn't be a truck, though, would it?
No, it wouldn't be. I don't know what to tell you about that, but...
he was a moron. That's right. Pretty much all you can...
Well, there you go. Well, yeah, but that's a great scene, and you're getting kind of this conclusion with her character, and then you've got De Niro... getting his woman in line to a degree, getting her in line, I guess, just sort of, she, like I said, she reluctantly seems like she's going to go with him. and Nate is getting all the information worked out for him. John Voight's character is basically his go-to guy, is going to get him passports and a surefire flight plan filed, private plane, boom, you're out of town, you're gone, and you're good to go, and probably never going to see you again, brother. Have a good life. And as far as Pacino's concerned, the trail's gone cold. He's taken the measure of this guy, and this guy's a pro. If they don't catch him in the next 8 to 10 hours, they're not going to, and there's a good chance that window is closing rapidly. So he's going home to the
hotel,
a Holiday Inn, you know, where he's been staying for the last day or so. He's thrown his TV out the window, out his car already, because he just doesn't give a shit. I mean, that scene was kind of just was what it was. It was kind of funny.
I like that scene.
Yeah, it's funny, but it kind of was like, whoa, okay.
It's him venting.
Yeah, it's him venting for sure.
Just look how he's driving.
Yeah, right. You know, you get this weird foreshadowing. He walks in, and then there's wetness in the carpet.
And he doesn't notice.
And he doesn't notice, which, you know, because he's distracted, or he's just, you know, as a detective, he should notice these things.
I am mystified how distracted I am anymore.
Right.
Especially these last few years. I miss so much anymore because I have so much on my mind.
Right, yeah.
That I just don't see anything. I'm, like, right. In my own little world all the right. time.
For sure. And, I mean, first time watching this movie, you're still... Like, you're at the stage now where so much stuff has fallen into chaos and so many stories have started to end that it's getting more focused, it's getting more concentrated, and you're kind of up in arms like, well, who's this going to be? What's this going to be? What's this water all about? I mean, is De Niro going to show up and pop him? That seems kind of weird, but what's going to happen? You know, the sky's the limit, and boom, boom, he goes to, you know, to use the restroom, and Natalie Portman's character's in there, floating in a bathtub. She just tried to commit suicide. She's the cry-for-help girl, because the one kind of relationship left in her life that she maybe was having any sensibility towards, and the one person who she kind of liked as a surrogate father was Pacino's character, and he seemed to have a genuine affinity and for her and affection for her. And it's like, oh shit, you know, the daughter's committing suicide here. And so he gets her all wrapped up and tries to triage her and get some tourniquets on her and rushes her off to the hospital and reconnects with his wife at that point. And turns out she's going to be okay, but they have their little moment where they talk and they kind of come to a realization that maybe this marriage is not going to work, that they love each other, but this just might not work. And, he gets a page because it seems like something's going on. The movie starts to move into its last phase. I mean, Kilmer shows up to pick up his wife from this location where the cops are. And that's the one thing they kind of gloss over is, I guess she presumably would have had a way to contact him.
Right.
And would have contacted him and said, hey, come get me, honey. I'm here. I'm at this hotel or whatever. So he comes to get her. He's changed his hair and cut his ponytail and all that. Changed his look because he's ready to go. And she's out of the balcony and she sees him to make sure it's him. Because the cops are all lined up and want to make sure, you know, like she's going to identify it's him. Then we're going to go in on him. She sees that it's him and he smiles up at her. She looks at him kind of concerned. And then she gives him the no way, no good. She betrays herself and betrays her son for him. This kind of irrational love that goes against the pragmatism that she's kind of represented earlier in the film with her risk and reward and all that. So he gets off and takes off. The cops do stop him. There's a moment of tension for her. And he's got all the right paperwork from Nate to say somebody else and looks different enough that, you know, the cops kind of let him pass. Apparently they didn't have their shit together and didn't have a quality photograph of him to the point where they could be like, this is clearly you. So that's a thin moment in the story too, but like you said when we were watching it, like, well, that's believable, you know, the just bureaucratic whatever, the three guys that would detain him down there might just not happen to have gotten a good photograph of him, you know.
Yeah, no shit,
it's just possible. And so he gets away. So now we have the Kilmer character either representing the guy that the thief that evolves to the next level, but he gets away, but he doesn't get to be happy by any stretch. He loses his family. He gets to live
with losing his family. He probably blew it all.
Yeah, and he probably Vegas, ended up dead in a gutter, buried in the desert in Vegas
Super Bowl
3 days later or something. Or, you know, eventually got caught. Who knows? His story is over now. Ashley Judd's story is over now. It's just Wayne Groves left, this loose end, this psychopath, this guy that nobody knows is this guy that's been a serial killer.
So De Niro is on his way to the airport to get away with his woman. He's going to go to New Zealand. That's that. It's the end of the movie. And he calls up John Voight to make sure everything was still good, confirm.
I was always upset that John Voight mentioned Wayne Groves.
But he does it, out of a sense of ethics that I think makes sense. And
well, he asked me.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you because you asked, you know, about Wayne Groves. He asked him about where he is and
if I were him, I would have. Well, do you still want to know? Nah. Oh yeah. Never mind.
right. You would have second guessed it a second, third time. Because he already had done that. He's already like, do you think you have time to take care of this guy? And he's like, oh, make time. You know, he's getting emotional, De Niro.
That was the first time, though, when he first asked about
it. Right, yeah, it was the first time. And so now he's got the information for him, and he tells him, and he says, but, you know, you're probably not going to do anything with it. And he's like, no. And for a moment there, he's like, he's not going to. And then it's just all performance. It's just all ticks in his face. And the music cues, and then they hit that tunnel and the light. And it's just... He's like going to embrace the emotions that he's feeling now as he's, you know, on this weird elation about to leave with this woman. And he's like, I can just, this will take 3 minutes. I can do this. This loose end is going to nag at me forever. And he doesn't know what we know as an audience. And this is the thing that's so precious about the film in a weird way, is that as the audience, we're the only ones that ever know about, like we talked about Wayne Grover being representative of like objective evil in the story, because it's hinted at that he's, not even hinted at, it's basically implied that he's been killing a lot of prostitutes, that it fits the MO when we see that one prostitute is killed, they talk about how it fits an MO that's happened. So it's been multiple prostitutes have been killed by Wayne Grove, presumably. So this guy's a psychopath, serial killer, criminal, scumbag, epitome of evil guy. This guy has to go, as far as the audience is concerned. There's no two ways about it. He betrayed these criminals who we kind of like on some level, because it's, you know, they're well-created characters, and it's fun to watch them do what they do. So we feel kind of pissed about that, maybe, but in an objective sense, this guy is bad, this guy is evil, and he can't get away.
Well, we dislike Wayne Grove from the very beginning, from the coffee.
Right.
On. He's just...
Yeah, he's a piece of shit.
He is a piece of shit.
And so we're sitting there knowing what Robert De Niro knows. And I was like, you can get away now, man. You're good. You can have the life you want to have. But fuck if that guy just doesn't need to go. And I think it's such an effective moment in cinema and whatever. I'll sound pretentious right now because this is the highest end of film and this movie... I will talk that way about without irony or anything else. It's really a moment where you kind of have to ask that question yourself. You have to be like, if I were him...
Oh, if I were him, I would have let it go. But then again, I wouldn't have done the bank heist either.
Then you're not there, you know what I mean? Like, you be at that moment, after all the other stuff's happened. Of course you wouldn't have done the bank heist, you wouldn't have... But
okay, if I had done the bank heist...
If you were at that moment, if you were at that situation where... Go get on the plane, leave, 30 seconds flat, or take this guy out. It's tough, I guess, because you have to kind of divorce yourself from the fact that as an audience member, you have that extra incentive knowing that this guy like needs the divine retribution for being a serial killer.
He needs a bet.
Because he's probably going to get away with it. I mean, he's killing prostitutes. I mean, what do you know? The cops
well,
are
going to kill him. Well, the guy, you know, he's going to end up going back to prison or get killed.
At some point, possibly. You don't really know for sure. How. I mean, you know the cops are kind of on to him, so presumably, eventually, they would pick him up for questioning on something at some point because they know he was a CI and they would want to know more information. But for now, they're staying cold.
Well, he obviously violated his parole.
Because he talked to some guys about something? Because
he's been associated with known criminals,
yeah.
So, however much...
On some level, yeah, right. They know they would come in on it. But I always know. I always look at it and I think... I just think I would have done the same thing. I can't let things lie, you know? I can't... I don't like loose ends. I can't. I would never be able to rely. I'd be sitting on that beach.
Well, you know what I would have done is he's kind of back in the system again.
Right.
And you just find out, and then you pay off somebody to kill him.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. There's all kinds of objective, rational, like 20 years later, 10 years later, 2 years later, whatever, you know, like you said.
3 months later.
Right. But you also have to be kind of off, too, and kind of dead, too, because who are you going to contact? You're going to call Nate in 6 months and tell him, hey, find out about Waingrow and maybe take him out.
Yeah.
I mean, that could work, too. But that's not the world he's operating in. He's operating the right here, right now, make the choice, you know?
I wouldn't have run off, either. I would have hopped in that car.
Instead at the end there?
There's so much confusion and all that shit. It's like, all you gotta do is get a little ways away.
Possibly.
You're at the airport.
Right. But the car was boxed in at that point, though. It was a stupid situation. So, okay, let's just do this. So he does. He screeches off and goes to take down Waingrow. He parks the car. He packs it so that it's backed out, ready to leave. And he goes into the hotel. He quickly contrives of a situation to get his number. And he, you know, changes his outfit so he looks like he's with security for the hotel. He sets off a fire alarm to cause some chaos. And he,
you know, I have never noticed that.
What?
Security.
That's what he did?
No, at hotels.
Oh, yeah. What about it? You never noticed it, or you never...
I've never seen them.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's a big Hilton, you know, by the airport. Maybe they have security.
I've stayed at a big Hilton by the airport.
Maybe you're not supposed to see them.
This was
1995. Who knows? Maybe rules have all changed. So, he kills Waingrow. Look at me. Yeah.
That was great. The look on Waingrow's face.
Right.
It looks like he's vanquishing some evil being, demon, whatever.
Right.
I mean, he doesn't even look human.
No, he's a beast.
Exactly.
And De Niro is a beast, too. De Niro is purely operating on emotion here. Because that takes, like, 20 extra seconds. The whole making sure he doesn't shoot him until he looks at him kind of thing. His brain goes reluctant for a minute because he knows it's his execution. He knows he's done. And so, of course, the cops are watching, but in the chaos, there's only one.
I don't understand that either.
What?
He calls for backup. Oh, just go ahead and shoot him, and we'll get to you in a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe the cop may not have given a shit whether he shot Waingrow.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, right, right. Well, he goes to... Yeah, he calls for backup, and then I think he rushes at the same time.
I love that Waingrow is totally at ease the fact that he goes out for ice.
Yeah, he went out for ice a little. Yeah, no, he's in the bathrobe and everything. He's chilling out. He's taking it easy on Van Zandt's dime at the Hilton under the name of probably his favorite spirit, Jameson.
Oh, Jameson.
It's another Intuit thing. It's another Intuit thing.
What the hell kind of name is Waingrow?
I don't know. It's a weird name, but it's a great name.
It is a great name. It's he'll always be Waingrow.
So now De Niro slips through the hotel after taking out the one cop that was there.
Doesn't take him out.
Well, you know, he knocks him out.
Knocks him out.
And he's about to get to his car when Pacino shows up. You know, Pacino was Paige. Pacino hopped on a chopper, knew that some chaos was going down where they knew Waingrow was, and he just sees him through the crowd of people that are exiting during the fire drill, fire escape. And there is that moment, you're right, where De Niro's right at the door and Amy Brenneman looks at him like, what's going on? What's happening? And De Niro,
the amount of time he stands there thinking about it.
Yeah. It's killer. It's supposed to be like big emotional stuff, and it is that. She gets out of the car as he turns to leave and leaves her like a, you know, pathetic creature that he is, because he's a criminal on the run at that point. And you're right, maybe get in the car. And I've thought about that a few times too. I'm like, what was he thinking when he pulled the fire alarm? Because the chaos is so much that there's fire trucks blocking the exit and stuff. That car was not going to be able to get out of there in any timely fashion, especially when he saw cops.
It was really a straight shot.
But there was people and cars and shit there. You mean really. Backing up?
Yeah, he just back up the way he came in.
Anyway, I don't think it would have happened.
It could easily happen.
So he darts off. Pacino darts after him. Amy Brenneman's left wondering. The music has now turned into like hunting music.
And then, you know, with all that chaos and everything, the amount of time it would take anybody to get around to pursuing, he would have been long gone. Especially when he... And then going through all the airports, bureaucratic bullshit.
Well, this is 95, man. He just goes. And Pacino just follows, and there's other people taking care of the chaos of the scene. It's just...
And I would have just... You know, at that point, I would have ditched out for the second time. And I would have just ditched the car somewhere. And called Nate and set up a third thing. Maybe at a different airport.
What do you think he was trying to do there? You think he was trying to get to that plane?
Oh, when he's running?
Yeah.
Now, as soon as he runs, he no longer has a plan.
Yeah, he's running, and he's no plan, and he's an animal being hunted by Pacino. And it's a great
scene. And that always bothered me, too, because he had the upper hand. He was the one being pursued.
Right.
All he had to do was just lay in wait. Boom.
Or just... End. Or, well, to a degree, he needed to find the right place. He just kept going.
Yeah, he just kept going.
Because, like I said, he didn't have a plan. He could have darted into one of those hangars and, you know, hidden somewhere. He could have done all kinds of things. But he doesn't. He just keeps going, and he ends up in a field. The scenery's great. I mean, they're on the fucking tarmac at LAX. De Niro runs in front of an actual 747. Like, that's all real deal shit that they did, that they staged. They shot it at midnight, and that they will never, ever, ever be able to do in a movie again. Ever. And they end up in the field by where the lights are, and there's that one little last moment with these communications towers or something. A little moment of cat and mouse and hide and play, and De Niro identifies that, well, these lights would blind him. But he forgets that they'd also cast a shadow, so he steps forward into the light, and it's this, like, very great imagery. And, I mean, up until this point, you know, you're with it. The intensity's there. I really remember watching it the first time. It's like, you don't really know who you want to live or die, or if they both will die, or what. I mean, it's kind of like it
could like go... Like Kyle and Lyle?
Kind of like it could go anyway, yeah. Just like Kyle and Lyle from Blind Fury. One of Lyle being Nick Cassavetes.
Nick Cassavetes.
Co-wrote the screenplay for Blow and is a director in his own right for quite a few films. John Cassavetes' son. Completely unrelated to this, the end of Heat. And, yeah, Pacino gets him center of mass. And that's the end of him. And he comes up to him, and De Niro gives him the whole, you know, I'm like, I wasn't going back, you know? Like, this is it. And they kind of arrived at the inevitable conclusion of the story. And the lights flash on from the airport, and Pacino just kind of takes his hand and...
And it's cold.
Connects to him emotionally on some level, because that's how Pacino has been. And they have their little moment of these two people... And in the commentary, man says, like, in his private, personal take of the film and everything, like, they're not the same, they're not different sides of the same coin or anything. Like, he's very explicit about that. He's like, Pacino is this police officer who has an emotional connection with people, who has a sense of, like, morality and honor and all that stuff. And De Niro is, like, a sociopath criminal who is cold. He has his friends and his people that he has some sort of honor among thieves towards. But other than that, he's very... You know, he's a criminal. He's a different kind of person than Pacino. But they both are, as he says, ego-centered people that know exactly who they are and what they are. And they're completely self-aware. And he's like... And man says that, you know, it's sort of that weird connectivity between two people that are so completely aware of who they are and what they are in a world that, especially in the story of the film, is filled with so many people that are unsure of things or... unhappy with things and uncertain of things and don't know which way is up and are just being sort of thrown through the chaos of the world of these lives that they live.
Is that Wingrow?
And settle for. Oh, well, Wingrow is just the pure evil component, right? And, I mean, it's a powerful moment between these two characters at the end there, and, you know, the music is great and the visual is awesome, and it just clicks, and it's...
It struck me... I was thinking about that when we watched that. I carried that song in my head for 4 years before I knew what it was.
Right, yeah.
And just hearing it that one time, I would replay it in my head. I remember a bunch of different times, like, you know how a song gets stuck in your head?
Right, yeah.
Well, sometimes it was just something I wanted to listen to because I was bored, I was on a bus.
Right.
Whatever. And it would just pop into my head. Or at a time where I was really stressed and I was waiting and I was anxious. And, yeah, without knowing who it was, and it would just, I would play that in my head, like my own little personal MP3 player. And I had a number of songs, but that one just always struck me that it was something that I had no idea who wrote, you know.
Yeah.
Who wrote it, and just hearing this it that one time.
Still, when it was tough to do stuff like that. I mean, we could have always looked the soundtrack up, and eventually I did, and that's how... Did I ultimately tell you?
Yes, yes,
you because did. I like the score so much. I like the music so much, and I mean, you showed me the movie. You had seen it before me, and I loved it, and...
Yeah, and that... I still remember that night.
Yeah, it was a fun night when we watched that movie.
And no, I remember the first night I saw it.
Oh, right, yeah, that...
I actually don't remember us. I remember that I showed it to you, but we saw... I showed you so many movies, and I don't specifically remember.
Well, I just do because it was my first time seeing it. I mean, you know, I don't remember much other than that. I remember that it was like a week before starting our senior year of high school, too, because I had just cleaned my room, and I never let my room get dirty ever again when I was had an incredibly dirty room for years. Like, I was the kind of guy that would have shit on the floors and stuff, you know, papers and garbage and stuff. Like, I honestly was that person till I was, you know, 17 and a half years old. I just got sick of it and cleaned my room one day really thoroughly, and I'd cleaned my room before and was just like, I'm done. I'm going to just keep my environment relatively clean from now on. And, I remember that, because the movie was long and it was late, and I remember going to bed up in my freshly cleaned room being like, I'm going to start the last year of high school, and I've started laying the groundwork for college and moving into the future, and I'm going to be living down in this environment, in this Southern California that I just watched be portrayed in this movie. And, yeah, the score stuff is solid. I mean, I remember the score from the trailer, because it was used in the trailer. It was used in one of the trailers. The end piece of music by Moby. And I remember hearing it. I remember really liking it. Because that was how I was with music when I was a kid. I didn't buy any of my own CDs till I was like 18 years old. Till like just before I left for college. I just hadn't owned. I owned like the 2001 soundtrack and the Star Wars soundtrack. I owned like two pieces of soundtrack music. But this was a unique score, the Heat soundtrack. Because it had all of these kinds of things in it, working in a film that was this sort of, like, neo-noir thing that didn't... Like, there wasn't, like, a lot of jazziness to this score. There's, like, not a lot of saxophony, you know, like, guy smoking a cigarette, having a drink, lonely. It's very... almost postmodern noir in a strange way. And,
postmodernistic dead tech bullshit house.
Yeah. It even comments on that. And so, yeah, so that last piece of score, that was really stuck with me about the film, was like that score piece, because I remember I wasn't watching it because I didn't watch movies with my folks when I was at that age. I had kind of given up on even hanging out with my family, and I think they were watching the movie, and I was upstairs, and I just finished taking a shower, and we have like a grating, a metal grating, that kind of a vent between things, so you every now and again, like when I was up in the bathroom, I could hear... And I always wondered about this. I always wondered if I was, like, dropping down a loud turd, if, like, everyone downstairs could hear, watch in the living room could hear.
No, that. I just imagine them with their...
Right.
What the hell they call those? Those large cones sticking to their ears.
Yeah, right, yeah. But I could hear... I think I caught some moments of the movie that they were watching it. And I could just hear the ending of the movie, and I could hear the music, and I just sort of stood there in the bathroom and kind of just listened, just kind of voyeuristically kind of got to enjoy listening to that bit of music through and getting what I wanted to from that movie for that moment. And that was kind of my first experience with the music and with the movie. And that was kind of my big point. I mean, when you initially pitched like me seeing it years ago, I was of course reluctant because I'm always reluctant about certain kinds of stories. I'm not a really big guy on dramas. Seeing them with people and stuff, I generally like to just sort of appreciate certain things that are going to be kind of more emotionally heavy.
You know, back then you were pretty open to watching whatever.
I was, but I think it was just maybe it was the length, and it was just the, like, it was Pacino and De Niro, and those guys always,
I'm sure that I lobbied it pretty heavy.
You lobbied it heavy enough, and eventually I was just kind of like, okay.
You relented.
I was like, I'll watch it.
I wore you down.
And like I said, I ended up really enjoying it.
I probably had carte blanche after that. That's probably how we fit in.
No, because usually usually what was great about you is that we had enough of a similar sense of humor and love for sort of the 80s stuff that we would like the oddball 80s movies like Dr. Detroit and
My Chauffeur.
Mischief and My Chauffeur and stuff.
I watched Mischief with you.
Yeah, we watched all kinds of goofy movies like that. And that was really what kind of solidified our friendship. But this was a solid one and a fun experience. And rewatching it again with you, and after probably 10 years since I'd watched it, so I've seen the film probably about 5 times. And yeah, it's a solid one. It's just the material. It's just the cops and robbers, but it's the best version of it. There's nothing you can do in terms of. I mean, like you said, you picked a few holes in it in terms of like, oh, well, the scanner, the guy would have known this maybe. And I've picked a few things about like, oh, the framing with the snapping.
But it's, for the most part, it's all real ridiculous. The only thing,
yeah,
there are certain things that are just going to bother you and you right. can't. And that's really, I mean, that's...
Yeah, it gets pretty petty.
The fact that you get emotional about the movie is really something. Not very many movies bother me to the point where you're just like, damn.
Yeah, and I...
Why'd you do that? But it has to happen.
Right. No, it's solid, and I mean, most of the things I would pick out would be, like, editorial choices or shot choices. I mean, there is a shot that bothered me early on. Not, like, early on, but, like, one of the last times I saw it before last, the dial on the elevator. There's like a shot that's framed one way of one elevator, and then it cuts quickly to like a Dutch angle shot on another elevator, showing, I guess, that like the elevators are counting down to the basement floor because he snapped the fire alarm towards right. the end. And it, for some reason, that Dutch angle shot to me just, it feels very amateur, just kind of shot, like it's just tossed in there. And yeah. You talked about this, like, we watched on Blu-ray, and I don't know if it's the transfer or if it's just the cinematography itself. It looks really good. It's got great visuals. I think a lot of that is good cinematography, but there's soft focus in a lot of places in it, too. And the framing isn't always perfect. Like I said, with the snapping and stuff. Now, some of that could just be on-the-fly stuff, but and some of it could be the nature of the transfer on the Blu-ray. But it's not as good as it could be, and that sucks, you know. So most of my issues are not with story. They're, like I said, they're superficial things that you only really critique when you're at the level of, I've seen this movie so many times, I've noticed these things. You know, it's one of those funny, weird things where it's like, oh, so on the 10th time you watched this movie, you noticed all these things that made you hate it? And it's like, right, dude, you watched it 10 times. I don't think you can say you hate it, you know? So, I mean...
This is one of those movies that gets an emotional response out of me.
Right, yeah.
And...
That's the key. You're right. You watch movies as opposed to documentaries or things like that because... I mean, not to say the documentaries can't do emotional responses, but, I mean, movies are inherently contrived because they're trying to use... They're trying to find truth through lies, basically. I mean, there's a more eloquent way of saying that, I'm sure. But and I take that to be something of real value is you say something about humanity through an artificial situation because you're condensing things and you're concentrating things and you're juxtaposing things and really creating this whole dialectic scenario whereby you can kind of create this intellectual exercise of looking at this theme and looking at these characters and behavior and the way all this stuff works out, and it's intellectually satisfying. And it's philosophically satisfying, and it's emotionally satisfying. That's not to say that they're all these open and shut yes and no questions that are answered thoroughly by the end, but it brings up these things. And that's what art's supposed to do, blah, 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 we get it. And I don't know if too many people... I don't know if I mean, I'm sure there are people that don't like this movie. And I'd always be I'd be curious if it's just a simple, oh, it's too long, wasn't really my thing or not. I remember I wrote a critique... for this movie when for a writing class, an English class, my freshman year of college, and the teacher hadn't seen the movie, and she rented the movie based on that and watched it with her dad, and she said, like, and in typical, like, you know, she was like making dinner or something, kind of like it had probably lost her interest to some degree, but her dad was sitting there watching it the whole time, and she'd come back and be like, this is still on? He's like, yeah, it's can't believe it, this thing's still on, you know. And it's like, and so she got a kick out of it. So that was based on my review of it. So I introduced somebody else to it that way. I know that there are things I'll see in other people's work that remind me of it, And I was recently watching the season 4 commentary for Venture Brothers. And there's a scene where there's like a hostage negotiation thing. And it's set at like an old drive-in. And in the commentary, Jackson Public talks about, like, I don't remember why I did that. I mean, maybe it's just that I really love Heat. And so, and it's like, that's a true fan to remember that scene. I mean, like I said, this, all the scenes are so memorable that if, unless you're just like blasé movie watcher, you're going to remember most of a large portion of the kind of stuff. Or you're going to, if you're a real fan of the movie, you're going to have seen it multiple times and be like, yeah, that scene at the somewhat inconsequential scene at the drive-in theater is just, yeah, I gotta stage an action sequence there. I gotta stage a hostage negotiation or a prisoner transfer or a drug deal or something there at an old drive-in. I mean, it's just a great location. And so, like, that's funny. I mean, I feel like this movie, because of the crappy Blu-ray transfer and everything, like, it needs... Maybe when it's been 20 years or 25 years, it'll get, like, the Blade Runner treatment where it gets, like, super pristine Blu-ray, like, Michael Mann maybe goes back and, like, there's deleted scenes. I didn't watch the deleted scenes on the special feature. And maybe he puts together, like, a four-hour version with some of those scenes. And, you know, and maybe they put together a whole, like, fucking two-hour-long behind-the-scenes featurette thing that goes through everything that they did. And has, like, all kinds of, like, other people who love the movie talking about the movie. I mean, there should be all kinds of... There should be, like, film noir comic book writers and all kinds of people, I'm sure, they could interview about this just to talk about it. Like, yeah. So, just because it's not perfect... Because it's not perfect... I can't, you know, give it a 5, but fuck if I don't want to give it as close to a 5 as is really humanly possible... I mean, it's like a 4.8 or something crazy like that as far as...
You know, I think I've only given out one other 5.
You gave Jaws a 5.
I gave Jaws a 5, and I'm giving Heat a 5.
Right.
And because I mean, both of those movies are in my top 5.
And you had more of a problem with, like, the context of the structure of the story than I did. I mean, in terms of, like, the lines and the conversation and stuff. I probably should give it a 5, but I think...
I don't think you've ever given anything a 5.
I gave one thing a 5 in a written review. I gave Synecdoche, New York a 5, but I gave that last 0.5 sort of jokingly because it had an airship in it in a movie that had no business having an airship in it. And I was like, it gets an extra half a star for... So it was really a 4.5, but I mean, I should have...
For me, Heat is a solid 5. In fact, if I could go higher than 5...
Oh. That's weird to me. I understand that people take, like, a practical sense of this movie is perfect in a practical world where nothing is perfect, but I still hold, like, 5 as, like, this unapproachable asymptote of, like, like, absolute perfection. And if I can identify things that I would have done different or things that are just don't work, then I can't do that. And it's as petty and stupid as his hand is out of frame when he snaps talking about angst. And I'm like, that's just a shit shot. That's bad framing. I can't. This movie's not perfect. Fuck. Fuck if it isn't as close to perfect as it could be, or as it should be. But, like, goddammit, you don't have enough
take. I don't go off. I don't. But I'm not.
Yeah, you're not as ingrained in the study of all this shit as I am. I'm not ingrained in it. And I'm doing everything. So, like, for me, I mean, I hope the listeners get that and take that with a grain of salt when I'm always giving things this and that and not... No, I just give stuff a 5 out of 5.
I'm grading something for the enjoyment that it's given me in my life.
Well, I'm doing that too.
And if something is... It technically would be possible, I think, for something... a horrible movie... For me to give something a 5 that was a horrible... Technically a horrible movie, but... Say, if there was a movie... Where I was literally rolling on the ground the whole fucking time, I would have to give it a 5.
I think that it would be impossible for someone to sit and watch the whole movie seriously and not get something out of it.
It's definitely a guy's movie.
I don't necessarily know. I mean, it does. In this fucking modern world where everybody's got to take the misogynistic twinge to everything and claim on it, just to try to earn pussy points on the internet or whatever. You can say, yeah, the women are all pretty weakly drawn in this film, and they're all just kind of there to serve or support or undermine the male characters. And there's a degree of that, but, you know, that kind of is another stylistic thing that goes back to old noirs. And really, if you look at it, the women are all pretty strong, too. I mean, they stand for what they stand for and want what they want, and...
Yeah, I really couldn't stand by that.
Yeah, I mean, but that's just the thing, you know. People love to do that. They love, like I said, to earn the pussy points. The men in the world, the podcasting men of the world love to be like, oh, this was so sexist and blah, blah, blah. And half the time you can just tell that any women listening to it or in the room are just kind of like rolling their eyes and like, yeah, uh-huh. So it goes. Moot point, buddy.
I scoff at that, but at the same time, there are those people.
Anyway, yeah. Heat's a solid one. Watch Heat. And, this was fun. Thanks, guys.
Is that how you're going out? Going out with a whimper?
I'm trying not to go out with too much acrimony or bitterness.
No bitterness.
Even though we just yammered on about all that shit that I may or may not keep in the podcast.
I was just assuming that.